Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Happy Thanksgiving. We got a lot to be thankful for here at the cast. I want to thank all the guests over the last year that have come on, people I could have never imagined talking to. I want to thank every listener, whoever spent even a minute listening to us, giving a chance, sharing it. And I want to thank our sponsors who believe in this little show. Okay, like Joe Fisher at Manskirt Brewing. Manskirt Brewing is a new brewery, about a year old, and they just make awesome, fresh, seasonally inspired ales. They're located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. I highly suggest you go check them out and give them some love on Facebook and Instagram. It's just a great place to go, and they're just growing and getting better and better and better. They had beers recently like Bedunkle Dunk and Hop Jostler, and it's just a cool spot, and awesome people behind the scenes. This week they got some Thanksgiving hours, but Saturday and Sunday they'll be rocking and rolling. So please take a visit. Do a little brew tour while you're up there. There's a bunch of breweries now in Hackettstown. So please check out Manskirt Brewing. Trivia Revolution. Okay, our sponsors at Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Each week they have different bonus items. You could win gifts to craft breweries around New Jersey. And they're just awesome company. They work... they got bars all over pretty much every night of the week if you look around and you're into trivia and whatnot. I host at Tap House 15, which, by the way, was an amazing show the other night. But I host at Tap House 15 on Wednesday, so come on out. Give them a like on Facebook. Follow them for the bonus item. And even if you're in last place, you could win all sorts of craft beer prizes. So it's a pretty great time out. So Trivia Revolution fueled by craft beer. Another awesome craft beer sponsor, Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. You got to check this place out. You got to go see their tasting room, the murals on the wall. You just got to go. They got 16 different beers going some days. Most Sundays, they release something new. They got a barrel program, a sour program. Demented Brewing is just a very awesome spot. I'm not just saying that because they sponsor us. We like to go there frequently. They just released Nightmare, which is their Belgian Strong Ale. And this coming Sunday, they're going to be releasing Beowulf, which is their robust porter. It's a brewery that just keeps getting better. They do all sorts of awesome things. You'll find days where they put things through the Randall. And just a very cool brewery. So give Demented Brewing a like on Facebook and Instagram. Finally, our longest sponsors here, Wolf Nation, W-U-L-F Nation. Stand for Wake Up and Live Free. Apparel for people who just want to make their own way in life, not wait for the man to pay them, not wait for the man to tell them what to do, but making your own way. So Wolf Nation, okay, wake up, live free. Go over there and send them some love. On this episode of the podcast, it's a very long episode, but it's because the guest was so intriguing and entertaining. His name is Tom Verney. He was a cop on the NYPD for 22 years. And he also is a gay man. And just to hear a man with so many viewpoints, how to be pro comp, the hiring process, how to deal with LGBT community, both in the workplace and while working as a police officer. Just a fascinating interview. He had a lot of powerful messages in it. So I really tune in and stay for the whole episode. Berlo's not with me this week. He's out North Carolina. But Steve Aspera joins me, and this was just a fantastic episode. So please give it a listen. Give Tom Verney some love, and enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Riley Breckenridge from Thrice, and you are listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cool and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Be a podcast without the dog barking immediately. Obi, what do you want? He's been like obsessed with this tennis ball all the last 2 days. Like he just keeps it by him and sleeps with it by his nose. But you won't hear Mike Berlew today. He's at work in North Carolina. I actually did a little call with him before, so I'll pop it into the podcast later. But you might hear a familiar voice if you go back a few episodes. I think it was 121 with Riley Breckenridge from Thrice. Steve Asparo, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello. Last time I saw you, we talked to Riley. I'm going to drink to that.
We did talk to Riley. And you know, slow news week. Nothing really.
The world is the same since you left and got back.
Not really.
Nothing really changed.
Nothing really going on. You know.
I feel great.
Yeah. I feel good.
I feel great.
I feel great. So obviously, Emperor Trump is now in office. You know, to me, it's a mixed. I have a lot of mixed. First and foremost, my first emotion is I am so glad it's over. The election is over. I see people losing friends over.
I know
political opinions. I see the worst, most idiotic Facebook posts over and over again. I've seen people I didn't know were just closet racists come out of all over the place.
Yeah.
I've also seen people who are so liberal crybabies that it makes me kind of sick. I'm like,
I almost have less patience for that than I do for people who you know are like racist. Like, you know, I'm not saying, and I've been saying this for a long time, and I will say it until, this is actually really good. Yeah. I've been saying it for a long time, and I will say it until Trump is out of office. I don't care if it's 4 years or 8 years. Just because he voted for Trump doesn't mean you're a racist. I don't actually think Trump is a racist. He said some racist shit, but it seemed like he would just say anything. Like, he was saying anything.
I think Trump, people call him an idiot. I think he's actually smart. Like, he just knows how to rile up a crowd and get them on his side. So he would, like you said, say anything.
He's an idiot when it comes to being a politician. Not being a politician. Being, like, you know, policy or any sort of detail. I'm convinced he doesn't know anything.
Yeah, ideas. He's
right, hard. He doesn't. He's not big on solutions. He knows the problems.
Working a crowd, though.
Yeah, but branding. not just working a crowd. Branding. Advertising and just hammering home, like when he said, and I've heard this before, but when he gave someone a nickname, whether it was in the primaries or general election, it stuck.
Yep,
it stuck no matter what. Jeb Bush was low energy. Hillary was Crooked Hillary.
Little Marco, Crooked Ted.
Ted Cruz. He's got low energy. Jeb Bush. That was the end of Jeb Bush. Low energy. Crooked Hillary. He never said Hillary without saying crooked, and that's it. And that's all it takes. He is a marketing genius. Listen, unfortunately, that's the only thing he's a genius at. I think
as a comic, I would hate to follow that guy on stage.
He
murders crowds. Gets him into a frenzy, you know? Yeah. Like, I would hate to be like...
Because you cannot do it.
Yeah. You're following Trump tonight. Oh, God. Yeah, you know, that's the worst spot in the club, you know?
Exactly. You cannot do him. But what I was saying is I think... and I lean left. I haven't hid the fact that I am more liberal. I kind of think of myself in the middle, but I do lean liberal in terms of politics.
I would say I mostly...
And the way I think...
I'd probably have... I would say maybe lean left, but... Yeah.
But I find the liberal crybabies, the people protesting. If you burn a fucking flag over this shit, that is so much worse to me than gloating over him winning. Or, you know, I really don't think a lot of people are the racists. But, you know, even if you are, like, you're saying stuff that's like kind of racist. Okay, there might be some truth to what you're saying. But it's not cool, but it's still, I don't find it as worse as this liberal just, they can't accept a loss. And
this is such a topic that we can go, it's so hard to like narrow down the one thing, but like the making it about themselves, like I think the liberals lost the vote because it lost the election because one, they stopped pertaining to like what people actually want, which is jobs. And they want safety for their family, and it became special interest again. And everyone's so, this and
it's the culture.
I'm going to wear the safety pin thing. Give me a break. Like you have to show people how great you are because now you've made it an attention seeking thing that you support gay rights and LGBT. You're safe with me, minorities. Like, no, how about you just be that person? You don't need to. You need to advertise it. Like, to me, it's just atrocious what the liberals have. And the riot, fine. You want to riot? I support your right to do it, but
now protest you can do. Riot, you cannot do.
No, it's just
You know, you want to protest? Okay, what are you protesting? What's going to change? We're not going to redo the election. They're not going to recount. He won handsomely. It wasn't like
I called it 2 weeks close. Before him.
Once it wasn't close. I said
the,
it too.
Yeah. Once the pussy grabbing thing did not affect anything.
Not yet.
Not one Trump supporter was like,
that's it. Yeah.
You know, that's it. Once that went, and then everything that came out with Hillary, then over and over and over again, and like people seemed way more fired up about that. And you looked around. I didn't see any Hillary posters. I didn't see any crazy Hillary groups going nuts. The Trump people were like,
but we live in New Jersey, and Hillary won New Jersey, so that's kind of like
given.
Like in New Jersey, I knew she was going to win New Jersey. New Jersey is very blue, and people weren't pumped about voting for her. But I knew she was going to win New Jersey because, but like, you just vote, like you just vote for her.
But on the opposite side, so what I mean by that is I see Trump signs in New Jersey, meaning like
that's
the passion that you see in Jersey. Think about the passion you see in Bama, you know, or somewhere like that. Yeah. You know, that's what I mean by that. Like, I knew, you know, they're going to win. They're, Blue's going to win in Jersey.
I had a big problem, and this is when I kind of knew he was going to win the election. I had the thing he did to me that was the worst was
Trump did something to you?
Not to me.
You want to talk about it?
To me, yeah.
He grabbed your pussy.
He didn't give me any money either. To me, the worst thing he did was when he mocked that Times reporter. Or
that was pretty bad.
The guy with the handicap. He mocked him, and everyone knew what he was doing. Everyone knew. Like, it wasn't like he was like, oh, I didn't know that's what he was like. Yeah, you did. You did, and you did it anyway. And to me, that was like, that was the straw. He could have said that the U.S. will be 100% solar by 2020, and I still wouldn't have voted for him because that was so despicable to me. I had an uncle who was a paraplegic, and it was like, that was just – it's unforgivable. Like, no matter how corrupt Hillary is and whatever, you can argue it. I don't really want to get into it, but whatever. She ain't perfect. I liked her, but she ain't perfect, and I voted for her, but she ain't perfect, and she fucking lost, and I got over it. I didn't burn a flag. I didn't protest, whatever.
You can now if you want.
Just, no, I'm not going to. You know, I'm not going to.
If you just want to do something crazy.
No, I'll drink a beer and be good. But you have to be somewhat presidential. There's a presidential quality of showing respect to people. He doesn't have it. And the country just decided that they don't care, and I'm kind of cool with it at this point. Yeah. I, like, the first day was shocking, but now I'm kind of like, I kind of want to see what happens. You know what?
Yeah. Here, you know, the thing that scares me the most is the not Trump himself. Trump to me is just whatever. It's just, I think the elections are reality TV. I think politics is about selling yourself and lying and just saying what hits the hot button in the room. You know, I think that's what politics basically is, minus a few people here and there. But the scariest thing to me is the type of people that now feel that their racist voice or their crazy, like, is now like warranted. Like, they feel,
well, there's all these stories coming out now, right, of all these hate crimes. And part of me is like, you know what, this is despicable. And on 60 Minutes the other night, I'll say it to the camera, stop it.
Yeah.
Right, you stop it.
Yep.
You stop it right now.
Uh-huh.
Once he won, now he can say stop it.
Right.
Before that, you don't, you know, I don't know who David Duke is. I have no idea what he stands for. Really? You never heard of David Duke before? Because I heard of him.
To me, it's not even the extremes of the KKK. It's just the average person I talk to. At work, I have like three big Trump supporters. And some of the things that came out of their mouth, like, I don't need to get into it, but it's just so overtly racist, and it's like now that it's given them some kind of feeling that it's okay to say that. Like, they've almost backed him as this.
Well,
I don't know.
What's the line? It's not illegal to be an asshole.
No,
not illegal.
I mean, it's fine to voice that, but it's more shocked me. Like, oh my god! Like, now they feel entitled to say it. Like, it's okay now.
I want
to
say something, one last thing about the liberals, especially the ones who are protesting. Especially these, there's college and high school kids, they're walking out of class. I noticed they waited till Monday to protest. They didn't do it on Saturday and Sunday because that's their weekend. Did you vote when we were in college? We were in college at the same time. We graduated the same year.
I did.
My first ability to vote was, I guess, 2008.
I voted.
So 2004, I could have voted because I was 20, and that was the second W.
Nope.
I did not vote in that election. I was not very politically involved, and when I was 20 years old, if I did vote, Election Day was just another day to get blackout drunk in college.
Yeah. I voted. I voted that. I voted the first Obama term, and I didn't vote the last one.
So Obama's first term was the first time I voted. And I assume most people our age, that was the first time they voted too. And so if you're a voter like me who I'm 32, the first time I voted was after college, was for Obama, and he won. And then I voted for him again, and he won. And then I voted for Hillary, and she lost, and she deserved to lose. So you know what? Fuck her. This is the first loss that this is the first loss that liberals are feeling, especially our age,
right.
And they don't know how to deal with it.
Nope.
Like, they've only had winners, nope. And now they have a loser, and this is what conservatives felt like for the past 8 years. And if this is how you're going to react, you know what? Get it together. The country's not going to – we're not going to explode. You know? What's going to happen? The Supreme Court might suck, but
listen,
nothing is
– It's always hard to be the candidate who is – not the incumbent, but the candidate who has to play the part of the country's doing great. We're going to keep it going. It's always easier to be a candidate of change, okay?
Yeah.
Either side. You don't run on a platform like, yeah, the country's pretty good. We're just going to kind of keep it going.
We're on cruise control right now, baby.
Let's just keep it at 70. You know, look left and right. And, you got to come in and you have to say how awful the country is. You have to incite the other side, enrage them, get them fired up. Country's terrible. You're going to get this, this, and this if you vote for me. And that's kind of how it seems to go, ebbs and flows. Very hard to be like, country's doing pretty good. I would change kind of a few things. People want that. The change candidate always, to me, has the advantage, especially after an eight-year term. Okay, you don't see too many eight-year same things. It almost has a natural history of kind of swinging back and forth.
She could not have been the worst candidate to combat that change. Because if there's a change candidate, what you have to do is tell people what's good right now. And the only thing she focused on was how bad he was. And she didn't get any fucking message across as far as, you know what? The country isn't that bad right now.
Yeah, I did not.
Not a lot of you are in that big of a, you know, especially mostly Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. Your lives aren't that bad.
Well, I posted a couple weeks ago. I said, you know, all these people are saying they want change so bad. Their lives don't seem that awful. Like a lot of them, you know, like, you know, like especially, you know, most of the people you're friends with, right? And you know, like their lives, most of their backgrounds, mm-hmm. where they work. And you see these people enraged about, we got to make this again. I'm like, dude, you kind of got it all right. You're kind of in the same boat as all of us.
I got into it with someone the same thing. Most of the Trump supporters I know, their lives are pretty good. And they got pretty good in the last 8 years. So I don't know what you're so upset about. But, I said the same thing. One guy posted on a friend status or something like, the big line is, Hillary's just going to be 4 more years of Obama, and that's what got us to where we are right now. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be like, could you describe where we are right now, and especially you specifically, because it seems like Obama's economy has worked out pretty well for you, and I'm sure there's statistics, and I know most of them if I look them up, but I know they're pretty good as far as domestic economy goes. So it's like, what really needs to be changed for you? Like, why did you feel that there needed to be a change? And I think the answer, you know, we know what the answer is.
Well, it's reality TV also. It's just that you got to root for a team, right? You got to root for the Mets or the Yankees here, the Devils or the Rangers. You got to take a side, you know, you got to get crazy and you got to ignore the everything a Rangers fan says. I'm going to ignore everything, you know, which is pretty much my philosophy in life. But
yeah,
no, but in general, like, you know, I use that as an analogy because, look, I've gone to, like, Mets games, right? Oh, in Philly, okay? There's the crazy Philly fans, the crazy Mets fans that never get along. But usually if you sit next to someone, you guys kind of share, you kind of share the same view.
I've had the same thing happen. I had Devils season tickets for 2 seasons, and Ranger, I would sit next to Rangers and Flyer fans all the time, and it's like, the section over from you is the asshole, but the guy sitting right next to you is the guy who he's like, oh, you know, the Devils aren't so bad this year.
And you know how many times
and I was like, yeah, the Rangers actually, you know, Lundqvist scares me. And he's like, yeah. And by the end of the game, you're boys, but it's like, you know, I would still fight him.
Right.
I would still fight him if he said
this
shit.
This is my point. This is the analogy I use, because there's the extreme right and the extreme left, and then there's always this thing in the middle where, yeah, there's this main difference. But you pretty much want the same things. You like your team. You don't take it too seriously, and you kind of want them to just win.
My favorite of this whole thing, and I don't like to harp on politics too much because it divides people. And I don't think I've lost any friends. I haven't checked my Facebook friend count in a while, but I think I'm still good. No one's defriended me. I posted.
You still have all 8 of them.
Yeah, yeah, they all like me. Hi, Mom. But we gotta go.
No, we're good. We got. About 15 minutes.
All right, cool. But I do want to say, and I just forgot what I was going to say.
Your last point was, you want to say something? Yeah, I was going to say one more point about, you said politics divides people, and then you...
Oh, right. Yeah. If you're not willing to hear the other side, if you cannot put yourself in the other side, if you cannot even imagine what the other side is thinking... Mm-hmm. It might be on you. It might be on the other side. It's 50 on you, 50 on the other side for not being able to articulate their point correctly enough to where you can understand it. Like, I get why some people are diehard conservative and they'll only vote Republican ever no matter what. I get it. Like, it's been explained to me enough times to the point where I understand the love of small government.
Yep.
And, you know, there is a fine line of people who walk the I can see both sides, but then there's a whole bunch of other people, and it's the majority of both parties that they are just team red or team blue, and there's nothing that's ever going to change.
Team donkey, team elephant.
Yeah, exactly. Team jackass and team fat ass.
Well, here's what first off, liberals and Democrats, I put this election 100% your fault. Okay. You had a candidate, you know, you had Bernie Sanders who ignited interest. Okay,
he would have whooped.
He would have destroyed Trump's now.
Ass.
In the same, you had the Bernie of the right versus the Bernie of the left. If it was the two of them, ignited interest. Bernie was smart, well thought out. Super delegates, which is a system based on when we used to ride horses. Okay, that is so antiquated. Whatever. I'm not going to get into that. But you blocked him out. You had your candidate. You had Hillary. That no one liked.
The Romney of the left.
Yep. So you suppressed, you lost votes right there, either to Gary Johnson or to non-voters or...
To Trump.
Bernie Sanders, if you looked at his campaign, okay, or especially early on, okay, when you saw like 2 years ago the video starting the post, if you looked at what funded his campaign, it was the Carpenters Union, the Metalworkers Union, the rural... working class jobs were behind Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was all about addressing those people. Hillary Clinton, never. In fact, she was like, oh, you know, we're going to take a lot of these jobs away. We're going to get rid of them. And she never went in and addressed the rural communities, the blue collar guys in these working class areas like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania,
Michigan,
like Wisconsin. The best thing, when they showed the map, where Obama got
Bernie might have won Florida.
All those votes Obama got, okay, in these rural areas, Hillary lost almost every single county in that area. And that's what lost the election.
And you know what? Everyone hates
the election never felt... Hillary's campaign never felt for me like it was a people campaign. It always felt for me like it was, I'm a woman.
Like
I'm entitled. I'm inherited into this position.
It felt like inheritance. Mm-hmm. Like her parents were dying and she was getting the estate. It didn't feel like...
It never felt personal for me.
Exactly.
Bernie pulled on my strings a little bit. If Bernie was there, I would have voted for him. I did not vote for Hillary, Gary Johnson, or Trump. I actually only voted on the local stuff.
Good for you. Yep. At least you did it. Good. I actually wish I did that, because now I have to say I voted for Hillary just because...
I wrote Bernie also. But,
good for you. Yep. I hate what the DNC did to Bernie, because now people can say... Now, not people who like Bernie, they're always going to like him. But people who were a little skeptical about him, now they can say that he sold out. And now they can say that he, like, buried all his principles to support Hillary.
Yep.
Even though she was the polar opposite of him. just because he didn't want Trump to win. And you know what? Bernie is not a hack. He's not a sellout. I don't think he's a sellout. Yes. Yes, he was running against Hillary, and then he fucking lost. And what did he do? He took it like a man, and he realized, okay, I lost. Yep. She won. Whatever system made her win, okay. But he realized Trump cannot win. So he put his efforts behind Hillary even after all that shit. And now people can look at him and say, oh, he abandoned all his principles. No, he didn't. He always caucused with the left, right? He always caucused with Democrats, even though he's been an independent.
Bernie had that. He gave me that little feeling that I had the first time Obama ran. Like, he had this, like, I mean, it's all politics. You're going to be let down most of the time in the end anyway. But he gave me that, like, oh, my God, this guy, like, is hitting on a lot of things that I agree with. And sometimes people forget, like, you should be voting more on what you agree with instead of just, I hate that other person. Like, you should try to identify at least an issue or two or three that you agree. I even saw you put a post up the other day about the environment.
Yeah, climate change is my huge thing, which is honestly the only reason I actually voted for Hillary. I hate Donald Trump. I think he is an asshole. And I don't think anything will ever make me change that view unless he does backflips this next 4 years, which I don't think is going to happen. But
physical backflips?
Maybe.
Physical backflips might get me on his side. No,
political backflips and policy backflips.
But maybe a few real ones.
Yeah, one somersault, and I'll concede. But the environment is massive for me, and he thinks it's a hoax, and she thinks it's real, and Bernie knows it's real. So it's like, that's really the only thing I voted on. So yeah, that was my one issue. I remember what I really wanted to say before. And that was this thought that we got to work together now. We just got to all come together, right?
Not now.
We you're over me. Yeah, we got to all come together, and we all got to work. And Democrats and Republicans have to work together to get the country to where we want to go. And it's so great, and kumbaya, and thank you. It's funny how this happened. I mean, and I've seen memes posted about this, but it's really true. And I kind of can filter out the liberal bullshit memes with my brain very easily. When I see them, it's like something's true or something's just like, all right, it's not that simple. This one is pretty simple. For the last 8 years, all the Republican Congress has done is obstruct. 6 years, I should say. 6 years, because the Democrats had the Senate. And now that Trump is in and they have the House and they have the Senate and they have 36 governors, right? And they're going to have a Supreme Court pick, and they might have two or three.
How crazy is that? A few weeks ago when the Republican Party was in turmoil.
They were done. It was the end of the Republican Party. Now they have everything.
They have everything.
Everything. They're going to have the Supreme Court for years.
Hillary Clinton's campaign may go down as the complete reversal of this country.
Worse than Jimmy Carter.
In 50 years.
Worse than Jimmy Carter.
Yep.
And Jimmy Carter won.
Yep.
But I love this thought that we have to work together now and all this stuff. It's like, you know what? For the last 6 years, all the Republicans have done has been try to stop and obstruct everything Obama has suggested, including his health care, which was based on their plan that they proposed in the 90s. Everything has to be stopped. But now that Trump's in and they can get whatever they want, we got to work together. Come on,
come on, people. Yeah,
we got to work together. And
smile,
it's like,
on
you know,
your brother, everybody get together, try to love Trump and his mother right now.
So I kind of take offense to that. We got to work together and take the high road and all this stuff. It's kind of like, you know what? If you really wanted to work together, there could have been a lot of good done over the last couple of years, but you didn't want that because the country needed to be in as worst shape as possible for you guys, for your team to win now.
Yeah, well,
and now that your team won, now is the time to whatever. And I just kind of, that's the bullshit I see through versus, you know, there's bullshit on both sides.
It's exhausting. I'm glad it's over. I'm so glad it's over. And you know what? The only thing I think you could hope is that Trump, like we said before, was just saying anything to get into office, and that maybe now he'll just listen. I mean, you already see the stupid reports. Who knows if that he's not going to repeal Obamacare, that he's not going to build a wall. He's going to build already he's backing off on things that he might have just been saying. But the only thing that scares me is if you look at the people who are pegged for his cabinet, it is absolutely frightening. Rudy Giuliani, are we serious?
I cannot stand that guy.
He's the worst.
I cannot stand
First
that
off,
guy.
He's not much more qualified. He was the mayor. He was not a governor. He was not a senator. He was a mayor.
He said this year, he said that no Islamic terrorist attacks happened before Obama got in office.
He did say that.
Really? You can't remember one? Not even one?
It's coming to me. A little fuzzy.
You'll put your finger on it.
It's a little fuzzy.
You've based your entire career on it.
A little fuzzy.
Yeah. I hate Rudy Giuliani. Nope. Every time I see him. But it's not even that. It's
Christie was mentioned. My favorite. The biggest disaster in...
Yes.
Now, two families now are going to be ruined because you're telling me that those two people did not get any orders from Chris Christie. What's their... I can't think of their names right now. The two people that just got proven guilty for Bridgegate. Yeah. You're telling me they're going to go to jail. Their families are going to be shot. And he's going to skate out of this? No way.
I love that the Trump supporters, they're all about Trump cleaning up the corruption in Washington.
Drain the swamp, bro.
Drain the swamp. Who we got? We got Giuliani and Christie lined up for cabinet positions. Really? Drain the swamp? Christie is the most corrupt.
You can't drain anything with Christie.
Yeah, exactly.
He's more of a plug.
Exactly. But you know what? As far as Trump's presidency is concerned, now that he won, I lean liberal. But you know what? All in. You know what? Put Hillary in prison. Build a wall. Deport 11 million people. Do it. Do it. If you have balls, you'll do it. You'll do it. And you'll make all your supporters happy. If you have the balls to do it, charge Hillary with war crimes and put her in prison.
Yep.
Okay? Build a wall 100 feet high across the entire border of Mexico and half of the border of Canada.
Yep.
If you have a pair of balls. If you have a pair of balls, deport 11 million illegal immigrants and see what happens.
Yep.
I don't think you have the balls to do it, but you know what? I want them to do it. I want – you know what? Do it. See what happens. See what happens.
He's a I don't know. We'll see what happens with him. I just don't know. It's
obviously,
like,
he's not going to do any of those things. No one will.
But it'll be like every other presidency. Maybe like 20% of what they actually said will get done. The rest will just be blocked through Congress and blocked through the Senate. And Donald Trump gets this credit from me. He pulled off the most unexpected most insane odds ever to become president in the history of the United States.
He broke Nate Silver.
Other than George Washington, who was the first. He was the first guy. They're like, hey, we need a leader. Like, one guy. Okay? He literally, he had no support from his party. He had no support from most of America. Yet he kept pushing through and figuring out. So that's where he gets the credit from me. Is there things he says that there's secret things that he says that I hope are done. I hope he does try to get rid of corrupted officials and get rid of all the money in government. Will it happen? No. Especially when I see some of the picks for his cabinet. It's just filling the swamp, if you ask me, to use his metaphor.
Just complete idiots.
You want to bring brains in there. You want to do something crazy? I mean, Trump was a Democrat for part of his life, so bring in half and half. Let's really try to, change it up.
It's not going to happen.
So
it's not going to
happen. Yeah, no, it won't. But, the optimist in me, I try to look on things like, listen, it's not that bad out there. It's not that bad.
This is what I try to tell a lot of people, especially, I guess, the liberals who this is the apocalypse. This is X-Men apocalypse for them. And it's like, you know what? I really don't think your life's going to change that much. The president doesn't really affect you. The only thing that's going to affect is the number next to your paycheck that says how much taxes get taken out.
And that might even take listen, by the time if Trump's out in 4 years, we might not even see some of his plans take place until 8 years.
Exactly.
From now.
And not only that, but people are talking about, well, what if he appoints a conservative to the Supreme Court and they overturn Roe v. Wade or LGBT?
That's a little scary.
And just but you know what? When is that going to happen?
It's true.
It's not like on inauguration day he's going to say, okay, this is my guy. They're going to get sworn in, and then they're going to immediately overturn Roe v. Wade. That like, come on.
If I was a woman, that
I understand.
That alone would be frightening.
I understand it's scaring. I understand it's scary. Roe v. Wade, as far as I knew, I was in college. I took criminal justice. Yeah. I remember that part of the lesson of like, okay, this is a big deal in our court system. I remember the
image of that imbecile telling me as a woman what I can or cannot do in my body is frightening. Okay, him saying things like, right. even last night on the 60 Minute or two nights ago, him saying, well, if it goes through, I guess a girl's going to have to go to another state. Oh, because it's just so easy to go to another state and schedule an abortion with some right. random yeah. doctor.
I mean, it might be
to
easy
me,
here.
That is more frightening than almost anything. Him telling women, like going back how many years now? Going back 70, in time.
60 or 70
going
years?
Back in time and telling a woman what she can do with her body.
To
me, that is an issue that I think is pretty damn serious.
It's a big issue. I still don't see it as the end of the world scenario because no. it's so far away and it's such a
that's true.
It's such a long shot to overturn Roe v. Wade, like a massive, massive court proceeding in our country. Like it's not just going to be like easy. Okay, it's overturned now. Like
even
the conservative justices won't just overturn that. Like
right.
on,
and
like
it's
going to
take trial. It's going to take
like yeah. there's so and. You know, I don't know. The state thing is.
Let's shift gears, Steve.
Oh, it's a good
you
idea.
Know what?
It's a good idea. We spent enough time on
it. We spent enough time. We could, like I said, it can go 10 different episodes of the podcast talking different things. But the guest we got coming on, I'm very interested in. I've been talking to him for a while. In fact, AJ Mattioli, who is an LGBT director, very in the community, recommended me to him to me. His name is Tom Verney. He was a NYPD officer for 22 to 25 years, something like that. He's also a gay American, so it's a very interesting. But he's out there campaigning completely in support of police and but also telling the public what police have done wrong in certain cases. So he seems like a very educated guy and a guy who has a lot of different angles. So I'd love to hear. Maybe we even get into some of this with him and see where he stands. So let's take a quick break and we'll get Tom on the line. Two, one, two.
Hello?
Hey, is this Tom Verney?
Yes, it is.
Hey, it's Scott Brennan. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? How's everything?
Great, man. First off, thanks for popping on the show. My normal co-host, Mike, is not here, but I have a fill-in here. His name's Steve. So, Steve, say hello.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Hey, Steve. What's going on?
Not much.
Tom, thanks so much for coming on. We've been kind of in talks for weeks now, just trying to figure out a day. You seem like a pretty busy man. You even told me right after this you're going to a little company called CNN for an interview.
Yeah, a little company.
Yeah,
I haven't heard of them. What is that?
But Tom, you Google your name and all different things come up. So there's a lot to really talk to you about. So let's start with your career. You were a police officer for 22 years, I think it said?
Yes. I was with the NYPD for just under 22 years. Retired about 3 years ago, almost to the day, matter of fact.
So you just recently retired then?
Yeah, I retired at the end of November of 2013. I was a detective when I retired. I was at the time I retired, I was working for the chief of community affairs as a citywide liaison. So I had about 15 different jobs there, but training and whatnot. But one of my primary functions was acting as a citywide. Well, two things. One is acting as a citywide liaison to the LGBT community, and I was part of a citywide response team in which. If anything seriously crazy happened, let's say, you know, planes that land in the Hudson River, police-involved shootings, gang shootings, fire displacing 200 people, anything large-scale like that that would make the news, Occupy Wall Street, yeah, I would respond. I'd be part of a team that would respond to that and try to bring some kind of order to chaos.
So then you were a major part of... you know, big news stories like or big events in the city in general. You know, like you said, playing in the Hudson, Occupy Wall Street. So you've seen
Hurricane Sandy.
You've seen basically a little bit of everything then.
Yeah, I mean, I've met two presidents. I met two popes. Down the block, I should say, from the North Tower when it came down on 9/11. I was there for the 1993 bombing. That was the first unit on the scene at the top of the Empire State Building in 1997 when a shooter went up there and did some damage. So, you know, Yankees World Series, Giants Super Bowls, you know, Rangers winning the Stanley Cup. I mean, I got to see a lot, you know, in almost 20
Wait,
years.
Wait, the Rangers won the Cup?
Huh. 1994, yeah.
Obi doesn't like that.
We're both diehard Devils fans here, so we try to erase that from history.
Ah, yes, it is true. The rumors are true. There was a time. Every 40 or 50 years or so, they grab a Stanley Cup.
Anything before 95 is a blur to me.
Right. It doesn't count. In 94 and beyond, it doesn't really go in the record book.
Like,
but,
like the Dark Ages.
Well, I think this might be the year, so we'll see. We'll try to get that going.
It's funny you say that. Like going into the end of the season, I thought you guys, your window was closed, but you made a couple moves that really surprised me, and I hate to admit it. They look good again. They look good again.
Leading the league in goals
per
game.
I also thought my Buffalo Bills were going to look good, and then you know they kind of faltered as well. So the struggle was real.
but
struggle
you
definitely real.
Tom, you've been like you're involved in so many things. I'm guessing you started from the ground up as your average police officer. And how did you actually get involved into the, like you said, the council or I forget the exact title you just said, but how did you get involved into those bigger kind of things, being a voice of leadership?
Well, I mean, I started off like everybody else. My family originally is from Bushwick, Brooklyn, so originally my whole family is from the city. And then I grew up in Long Island. I grew up in the West Babylon area of Long Island. But growing up, I was kind of talented in art. I didn't really have the math skills to get into automobile design because you kind of need an engineering degree. And I failed algebra in ninth grade, so that wasn't really working out too well. But ever since I was a kid, I'd always wanted, one of the things I'd always wanted to be was a cop, because I grew up in a family that had a number of police officers in it already. So it was just kind of something from the time, whatever it is that people first ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up kind of thing. And so I kind of did that. When I started going to college, I originally was taking advertising, art, and design, and like everyone else, I changed my major, 3-4 times. And then the academy called. I dropped everything, ran there. Started off on patrol, the first year I was on was the year right after the riots in Washington Heights. So I spent quite a bit of time uptown, even though I was assigned initially to the 17th Precinct, which is in Midtown Manhattan. And so I spent some time up there, and things were crazy back in the early 90s. You had 22 to 2300 people being murdered a year, people being killed like it was for free. And crack was whack. I mean, crack is still whack. But back then, it was all over the place. So we had a lot of problems back in the early 90s. Crime was pretty much peaking at that point. And so I was on patrol for a while. I did community policing. I got involved in that as a beat cop. Did some plainclothes work there as well. And eventually, I was trying to get over to the Warren Squad. And a friend of mine was working in the academy. They were having a new addition of a new instructors coming in. They asked if I'd be interested in teaching. And I said, I thought I would probably do that later on in my career. But just for shits and giggles, I kind of ran over there and did the interview anyway. And, they liked the way I presented, and I wasn't afraid to speak in front of a group of people. So I went through the training process there and taught behavioral science in the police academy. I taught 6 back-to-back classes that came through from, late 1998 through 2002, early 2003. And then I tried to make a second run at the Warren Squad. And on my way there, I got kind of shuffled over into community affairs, because at the time, they were looking for people to come in and do training, and they also wanted people, they're expanding their liaison program. So they wanted a liaison for all the major communities that they had in the city. Aside from doing training, I was also going to be tasked with having the responsibility of being the citywide liaison to the LGBT community, because up until that point, there really hadn't been any. There were a couple of ad hoc people that had been there in a position similar, but there hadn't really been any serious on-the-ground outreach. I felt it was important to kind of, get that outreach rolling, because there were 2 groups, in my opinion, that were really lacking where the outreach was not done, and that was LGBT youth and the transgender community, and because they had neither one had really had a seat at the table. So that's kind of where I focused my outreach for a number of years. Shortly after getting into the position, what I started also doing was working with groups like the New York City Anti-Violence Project, where a lot of people would go with their problems. They wouldn't come to the police because they didn't trust the police, or they had gone to the police and maybe didn't get the service they were counting on. So they would go to an organization like that. They had been attacked, perhaps, and by the way, of a bias incident of some kind. And stuff like that needs to be reported right away. So, they would call me, and I would kind of be the intermediary, many times taking the initial report, for that incident, and then kind of almost kind of walking the victim into the precinct in which it occurred, and, you know, then starting the initial investigation of that incident, whatever it happened to be. Many times it was bias-related. And then, you know, having the Hate Crimes Task Force go and do what they do really well, which is investigate those crimes and apprehend those responsible, then try to, you know, get them through the DA's office, get them charged appropriately. Because if someone's, you know, not only prosecuted but convicted of a hate crime in New York, there's been a hate crimes law on the books since 2000, and they would stand to do double the jail time than they would, you know, for a crime that was not a hate crime. So... Yeah, so I, over the years, I tried to do that outreach. I think I was fairly successful. I was able to make some changes in policy, as well as some of the training before I left.
Yeah, I mean, just hearing you talk, like it seems like you have a very deep insight into a lot of different things, and it almost seems like you're trying to shorten that bridge between. People who have been put down, or like you said, when you said like, hey, people are very nervous of the cops or don't trust the cops. It sounds like you have like a. It's nice to hear that you had an initiative to kind of break that wall down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I understand people's apprehension towards the police. I get it. I mean, it's not really that difficult to understand. I think, and I think, quite frankly, I think a lot of cops do. I think probably more cops get it than people stand to realize. But, and, you know, again, whether you go into the historical, you know, concepts of police versus community and vice versa, socioeconomic and historical oppression of certain groups of people and whatnot, you know, listen, we built this. You know, the United States of America is not a perfect... you know, republic or democracy. It's been 240 years of trial and error, 400 years of settlement on this land. And we, you know, we're still not getting it right. And, what I try to tell people is, you know, to try to have a leap of faith in the police departments, in their respective police departments, wherever they happen to be, but particularly with the NYPD, in that there are 35 to 36,000 people within the NYPD. It's the largest police department in the country, if not the world. And, by and large, I think the overwhelming majority of them are very professional. I think they do the job day in and day out very well. But, you know, Lord knows we have our problem children, just like anyone else does. The problem is that people hold the police to a higher standard, which they should be held to. But when it gets down to it, 6 months of training in the academy, when training fails, then you kind of have to hope that the person that you're dealing with is a decent human being at baseline. And sometimes what happens is we wind up with some people that have some issues, and they have either slipped through the cracks, or after 5 or 10 or 15 years of dealing with the worst that humanity has to offer, you know, the psychological damage from that is such where they kind of just lose their way, and they just, you know, are not, they kind of need to maybe take a step back, and they kind of get caught up in the grind, and they kind of lose their sense of what they're doing out there. Not that I'm making excuses for anybody, but that's just kind of how it is. You know, that's what happens with police officers, I think, many times, is that they kind of almost... forget, you know, the general construct as to why they're out there. you know, and then they lose themselves in that, and it becomes an us versus them mentality. You know, they whether by happenstance or by design. Yeah, I've been doing some work part-time with a company called Blue Courage. If you go to bluecourage.com, you can read more about it. But their mission really is to restore a sense of nobility to the profession of policing. And that's what drew me to them. They're a company based out of Illinois, but they work nationwide. They've done training here in New York, Chicago, Baltimore. I've done training, you know, in Tulsa, San Francisco, Maricopa County in Arizona, where they've had some issues, down in Florida, where there's been some issues. So they do training all over the place for cops. And the recurring theme is that I think cops nationwide, I think, just feel kind of beaten down. They don't feel like they've gotten the respect level from the public has dropped. They don't feel like they've gotten a real good fair shake from the Obama administration, regardless of who the Attorney General has been or whoever has been in charge of the DOJ. And, you know, and again, by and large, most of them, the majority of them are out there doing the job very well every day. I mean, you know, my whole thing is that if we had a systemic issue with policing where 800,000 police officers nationwide were a bunch of racist stormtroopers, we would need a news channel 24 hours a day, 7 days a week just to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, again, by and large, the majority of them do the job very well, but as we've seen, especially in the last couple of years with a lot of some of these high-profile cases, there are incidents where, you know, there are some police that have not done the right thing. And, you know, for as many times as I've been on CNN or BBC or Fox News, you know, I'll be the first one to advocate on behalf of the police because I have a natural bias because I was in the profession for over two decades. But having said that, I've also been the first one to come out and say and call the police out when they've done something wrong. You know, case in point, if you talk about, let's say, Walter Scott down in South Carolina, where the officer there, you know, they get into a physical confrontation and he breaks away from the officer and the officer shoots him in the back five times. I can't possibly justify that. And I said, I was one of the first people to come out and say that guy should be fired immediately and he should be put in jail for the rest of his life.
Tom, you've made... Sorry to cut off. You've made so many good points with this one answer. It's something that I think a lot of the public wishes they would hear from more police officers who aren't retired. What is it about retiring as a police officer that brings this whole new perspective to the job? Because anyone who majority, I don't want to say anyone because I refuse right. to just lump anyone into just a category of, you know, one way of thinking. But the overwhelming majority of people who are on the blue line right now will not go against an officer no matter what just because the job is so dangerous. And the public understands the job dangerous, but like you said, you have to be held to a higher standard because you're in a position of power. And at right. some point, the power is abused, and that has to be punished, in my opinion, more than the average person. But I can understand even to the extent of an average person who doesn't have a position of power. So what is it about retiring, and where is the gap, and what can you do to get maybe current police officers on your side to maybe at least admit that some of the recent high-profile cases were an overstep of boundaries?
I don't know if it's so much about retiring. I mean, look, when you retire from a job like that, you clearly get a different perspective of things because now I can view it as, you know, Mr. Tom Verney versus, you know, Detective Tom Verney. So I can opine on all these incidents that have occurred. I can put myself in the place of those officers, having been in similar situations and you know, knowing how making a split-second decision has a tremendous ripple effect, not only on the person that it occurred with, but also the community in which that person lives and the larger community as a whole when we're talking about nationally. So, when we talk about the Ferguson effect, you know, that there's a reason that people are calling it that because that one incident virtually affected just about every police department across the United States. It was talked about and training, it was, you know, was reexamined and potentially training in some cases was altered or updated or modified to kind of address that kind of a thing, just like it was back in the day with Rodney King, you know, if you want to go back a couple decades. But I think, though, there's a bit of a disconnect between perception nowadays is nine-tenths of the law, in my opinion. There's, and I used to see this, and I'll give you a good example. We used to have a course in the NYPD called the Citizens Police Academy. And a lot of large police departments now have something similar to this.
Yeah, I think there's been some viral videos going around of that as well.
Yeah, and so, you know, with the NYPD, it's a 14-week, 13 or 14-week course. You have citizens that sign up for it. There's a waiting list a mile long. They put a class in twice a year, the spring and the fall. And they get about 150 to 200 people that come through the class. It's one night a week for 3 hours. And you learn in a dozen weeks or so kind of a crash course in what a recruit would learn in 6 months. What that's meant to do, and everything is very transparent. The materials that are given are the exact same materials that the recruits are reading in their classrooms. The instructors are the same instructors that are teaching in the academy. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing removed. There's nothing, you know, no sleight of hand, you know, no cards up the sleeve. And it's done that way purposely because the people that we're looking for to come in are not people that are waving the flag, you know, for the police and bringing us, you know, roses and apple pie. We're looking for the people that have legitimate, serious questions about what goes into police training. You know, what are you teaching those robots in the academy is basically the people we're looking for. And, we give them material, they can read it, and then they sit in the class and they talk about it, have a very honest discussion. And the objective is to raise the level of awareness as to what goes into police training, because a lot of people have no real clue,
right?
Really, about what goes into police training
at all.
A lot of right, and what people know about the police is what they see on TV, and you know, as far as breaking news, TV shows that are out there, and movies and whatnot, which are all sensationalized and based very, very loosely on some sort of fact. There's, you know, 10% truth, and the rest of it's made for TV. Entertain you. So what happens is people think they know everything there is to know about law enforcement, and then they'll be the first one to Monday morning quarterback when an officer does, not having an ounce of law enforcement experience or training. So, you know, what happens is I think a lot of the cops, too, another misconception, I think, is that the police, active police, will not call out an officer if they've done something illegal. And that may have been the case 20, 30, 40 years ago, but with as much oversight as there is today, and the integrity level, in my opinion, is much higher today than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. And only from personal experience, I saw firsthand cops that called out other cops for everything from someone who may have been having an alcohol issue, someone who may have had an issue at home, maybe, you know, some sort of domestic violence, cops that were potentially doing something illegal, any whiff of that, there was, you know, people would make calls or just outright just tell internal affairs or what have you. So, I mean, I saw that firsthand, and people don't see that, and that's what's missing in the narrative many times in the media is the stuff that actually really happens versus the perception that cops will not. Now, and having said that, again, playing devil's advocate, are there cops that have done something wrong where there are other cops that stand by idly and do nothing? Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that unfortunately, I mean, not unfortunately, but reality is that's the case in every job. A job I work during the day, a couple bad seeds ruins it for the whole batch. And I feel for you guys in that aspect because I have family members who are cops and I have cousins who are cops, and they say the same thing. They say things similar to what you're saying. They do feel the pressure of the media and the way it's portrayed and things like that. And a lot of them are doing the right thing, but they say it is the couple cops that do the wrong thing that really is, you know, spoiling it for them. I have a cousin who doesn't even tell people, like, he'll meet, like, what, like, if people say, hey, what do you do for work? He's like, oh, I work government security. Like, I work a security job. Because he doesn't want that, A, either backlash, or B, like, what do you think about, like, he doesn't want, especially on his downtime, he doesn't want, what do you think about the Ferguson case and this and that. Like, Tulsa. He doesn't want to be pinned against the wall right away.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's interesting is to me. I'm white, okay, and I would many years, you know, whether it be on patrol, when I worked uptown, Washington Heights, and a little bit in Harlem at that time, back in the early '90s, or even in community affairs, where I worked in just about every community in the city. So I would be in East New York, I'd be in the South Bronx, I'd be in Harlem. I can't even begin to tell you how many times that I would go into any of the communities, communities of color, and the looks that I would get, the side eye I would get, even before I even said hello, the look that I would get of disdain in that, trying to initiate a conversation, it was the feeling was that I was already being signed, sealed, and delivered, that I was not going to give them a fair shake. Because, oh, here it is, another white cop is coming to, and quite frankly, some of them would actually even admit that. They would admit to me, like, and at the end of the conversation, when I treated them completely professionally, and in some cases that may have even called for a summons, let them go with a warning or what have you. And then they're looking at me like they're looking to see where my spaceship landed, because they're like, this is not the like they're like, where did you come from? And I'm like, I came from the same place everybody else came from.
Yeah, I mean, but for a lot of, from their perspective, that whole sign, sealed, delivered thing too, they might be seen as, a certain stereotype,
Well, criminal. It's a bias. Listen, the same way that what I try to tell everybody is that, we still live, overall, we live in a very racist, sexist, homophobic society, right? Oh, just in general. I sometimes refer to the United States as the divided states of America. And as a matter of fact, I did a blog post on it. I have a blog called offbeatcop.com.
I'm on it right now.
Yep, there you go. So if you look back a few, I did a blog post specifically on that subject where, I've been saying this for a long time, that we still, unfortunately, people don't want to admit it, but we live in a racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic society. And the police are a subculture of our overall culture, right? So if people want to fix the police,
right,
and yes, the attitudes that may come along with it, then they have to start right in their own communities, because you have to get to a point where we as a society overall finally, once and for all, get sick and tired of being sick and tired of having this cancer of racism and sexism and homophobia in our society, where we're treating people like second-class citizens based on what they look like, what religion they preach, who they build a relationship with overnight or long-term. So it doesn't – once we can finally get past all that bull crap and then act humanely as humans, then you will build a better police department. But that takes – kind of takes a village kind of a thing. It takes a lot of work to do that. It takes societal – change. It takes a shift in our overall society, and people, not to coin a phrase, but you have to be the change you want to see. Yeah. Tom, so if you want to continue to treat people like garbage, that garbage in, garbage out, that's what you're going to get.
This is such an interesting topic, and the fact that you said that the police are a microcosm of society, and they're going to be only as good as society is, and society isn't perfect, so police aren't perfect. That is such a great point. And the point you make about society's racist and homophobic and sexist and transphobic and theistphobic, whatever it is. Because if you look at the police, it's hard to tell if the police are real. Everyone wants to say they're racist, and everyone wants to say they target Muslims or a religion. So how is it, especially because you are, I guess, a homosexual man and you used to be a police. What is the sexuality versus race and religion in policing? How is that? Because all we get from the media and all we get from, I guess, understanding as a whole is race and maybe a little bit of religion. And it seems like you have more in there about some sexuality preferences that people may not know that go on.
So within the police department, like how's it dealt
right? Like, is there any not only towards police but also towards the public? Because a lot of people would say, just the easy thing to say is police are racist because a black guy got shot or whatever, and there's no context to it. But people may not know that police might be homophobic or sexist or transphobic, or there might be a discriminatory aspect to that. Is there anything? Is there any light that you can shed that people don't know about in that aspect that maybe deserves a look as well?
Well, I mean, just as a standard state of affairs, I mean, police departments across the country, you know, they all have similar, you know, some of the rules are similar. It's kind of standard, standard training that, you know, across the country, standard methods of training, I should say, and standard mission statements and what have you. And just about at this point, I would just imagine, without knowing 100%, just about all police departments have a standard, you know, policy where you cannot racially profile, right? You can't profile against someone's religion or someone's mm-hmm. sexual orientation. That's just there's a zero tolerance policy for that now versus maybe 5 or 10 to 15 or 20, 30 years ago, which is great. Now, on paper, mm-hmm. whether or not it
on
is
on the book it says that.
Yeah, it's on, you know, it's in their policies, it's in their procedural guide and what have you. Now, is that always practiced? Who knows? You know, that is a top-down initiative from whoever that commissioner is or that chief or that commander of that department. They have to practice what they're preaching. So if the commander says, you know, listen, we're not going to tolerate racial profiling, then it falls, you know, it falls on him or her to exude that and to act that way. You know, if there's an understanding that, okay, well, you know what, these are the procedures, but listen, we're going to go out there and do what we have to do and whatever, then it's not going to work. I think what's happened over the last couple decades, at least that I was in the NYPD, was that there was a pretty dynamic shift in the mindset of the cops from when I first came in 1992 to the time that I left at the end of 2013. In that, well, I was outed by another cop. When I was only there maybe about a year and a half or so when that happened.
Wow.
And I wasn't out to anyone at the time because my fear was, my internalized homophobia, if you want to call it, was that I was fearful that, A, I was not going to be treated the same if they found out about my personal life, and, B, more importantly, that I felt I was fearful that they were not going to back me up if I needed help in the street.
Wow.
Because that had happened in years prior. So, you know, long story short, I got outed, and one of the first, and it's this guy who had maybe about 3 or 4 years on more than I did, was the one who felt that he had to be, you know, the town crier and tell everyone about it. So for the 3 or 4 days I was away, during that weekend, you know, I came back and, you know, I left on a Thursday or Friday, and I came back on a Monday, and 250 people knew, from civilian typist up to captain. And this guy was ripping me to shreds one day in the lounge in front of a couple dozen cops because they were watching Jerry Springer's and Drag Queen walk down. They're like, oh, look at Tom Verney. And they're like, and some of this before everyone found out. And some of the guys were like, what are you talking about? And they're like, oh, yeah, didn't you know Verney's a fag? And, you know, he's date girls and now he dates guys. And that's messed up that he's like that. And I wouldn't want to work with someone like that. You know, those people, quote unquote, don't belong on this job. And there was kind of like this sound, because some guys didn't know. There was a lot of rookies in the room at the time, and they were kind of like, some of them were finding out for the first time.
Right.
Some of them were, you know, kind of like, oh, my God, I can't believe that's true. And then this one guy who happened to be, we used to call him Pops. He was one of the more senior guys in the precinct. And he was a Marine, you know, heterosexual, married, 2.3 kids, a house with a picket fence, a whole nine yards.
2.3 kids.
And, you know, so he got off, up, he was laying down on a couch in the lounge, and he gets up off his couch and he walks over to him. He had probably about almost 15 years on at that point. He was the most senior guy on patrol in the precinct. He walks over to this guy and he stands over him. This other guy was also laying down on another couch, ripping his shreds. And he kind of looked down at him. He says, like, you know, what's your problem? And the guy's like, oh, well, what if I'm working with him one day and he's, you know, we're in a car, we're on our way to an emergency run, and he puts his hand on my leg. What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
So, and the guy was like, are you insane? because that's what I'm thinking of. You know, like, if we're on our way to a guy with a gun, yeah, you know, just in case we literally bite the bullet, I want to get one last free grab.
That's what puts you in the mood.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, that's kind of how I get my rocks off. So.
All right, I'm sorry, Tom, but now we have plenty of space to talk.
Excellent.
But you, just by what you're talking and knowing a little bit about you just by research and being recommended to you by, give a shout out to AJ Mattioli, put me in touch with you. You are, you don't realize how valuable of a tool and a person whose story should be heard all over the place. I mean, you are, you know, you're working with, you know, people who have been suppressed and don't really have a voice at times, but yet you're doing a job that when people picture is a hyper-masculine, straight, you know, and you've been through the, you know, the making fun of it. Now, how did you adjust, like to that after you were outed? Was it just kind of like whatever after that? Or, like, did you fight all the way through your 22 years?
Yeah, I was wondering.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't. The funny thing was is that there were some guys who thought that I was maybe putting on a show, you know, that I was, I don't know, maybe trying to act, you know, like more butch or something like that to kind of cover the fact that I was, you know, because, you know, when people ask me about my personal life, I was very vague about it. You know, so some say, oh, you're dating somebody? I'm like, yeah, I'm dating somebody. I'm like, oh, what do they do for a living? Oh, they work in a bank. Well, what's her name? Oh, did you see that Yankee game last night? You know, I was kind of just shift the subject and kind of bounce it off. And then, so no one really, what people knew about my personal life was very little. I kind of kept it that way for quite some time.
Right.
And when this one cop decided to out me to everyone else, and then this other, you know, veteran cop, like I said, this guy Pops, he stood up for me. He didn't know at the time that he was a straight ally, but he was actually, that's what he was doing. Was that he stood up, I wasn't there, and he didn't have to do it. He took it upon himself to say, you know, listen, Tom's a nice guy. We're all friends with him. We all work together with him. And at every emergency, he's the first one there, if not one of the first people there. He's not afraid to do the job. He's very competent at what he does. So if you don't want to work with him, I'll work with him. And if he wants to put the moves on me, you know what? I've been married for over 20 years. I'd be very happy to get some attention. I mean, so, but, and that changed that one person, and then subsequently a couple people thereafter, they... You know, they made a significant impact in the mindset of what the other cops were thinking. But I wasn't doing anything, again, to kind of put on a show the way I was when I left on, other than being vague about my personal life, the way I was when I left that, you know, on that Friday and I came back that Monday was still the same. The only difference now was that they all knew.
Right.
And now, but it really put the ball in their court because they had to decide, you know, one of three things. Either to treat me better than I was before, which I wasn't looking for any kind of special treatment. Treat me the same as they did last week, which is exactly what I was looking for. Or to treat me as a second-class citizen. And I kind of put the word out that I said, listen, I'll be willing to answer any question. If, you know, people want to ask me about the whole gay thing, I'll be more than happy to entertain that conversation. And at the, I'll give you information, and then you can change your own opinions about or not about it. But at the end of the day, if we can't work together, if I can't trust you with my safety, because you can trust me with your safety without a doubt, and because that was already proven. Right. But from this point forward, for the 8 or 10 or 12 hours that we're going to be working together, I need to know. You may not agree with the whole, you know, the whole gay thing, so to speak, and that's fine. If that's your personal opinion, for whatever reason, not a problem. I don't have a problem with that. But we have to work together for 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day. And if at some point my safety is going to be jeopardized, mm-hmm. because you think I need to fend off whatever evil forces are out there, mm-hmm. just to prove that I should not be on this job, then that's a problem. And I knew what my rights were. Yeah, I could have gone to EEO or made a complaint to my captain or whatever it was if I was to be treated that way. But I kind of put it out there that if someone had a problem with it, then we can have another conversation. That conversation would be after work, down in the garage, and then you can explain to your friends why a gay guy broke your nose.
Nice.
You know what I mean? And I wasn't. Yeah. But the thing is, I wasn't seeking a physical confrontation with another cop, but I was putting it out there that I was not going to be treated like a second-class citizen.
I'm wondering, and I do not want to harp on this whole you were a cop but you were gay thing any longer than, do you think it was easier to be outed like that and kind of just like a Band-Aid? Or would you have rather done it? I'm sure you would have rather done it on your own terms. Or was it easier to just kind of, you know what, it happened. It happened over a weekend, and then from there it went good. Like, how did it affect you like that? Was it, I'm sure you didn't want to get outed like that, but the fact that it happened, no. Was it almost easier for you to kind of just be like, yeah, so what?
It was, but it wasn't at the same time. It kind of made me have to be a little more forthcoming.
Tom, real quick, what year was this? Also, out of curiosity,
This was late 1993, early 1994. Okay. Right. Literally, right around the holidays.
All right. So yeah, a little tougher then.
Yeah. Well, because what was interesting was just that aside from that first initial cop, Pops, you know, who happened to be a white guy as well, the first set of cops that kind of came to my, not to my rescue, but I guess to my side to support me, were the cops that were black, Hispanic, mm-hmm. and female.
Right.
And inevitably, you know, a large majority of the male white cops, the male white straight cops, did, you know, kind of come, take me aside and say, okay, listen, we got your back, don't worry about it. You know, but the first group that came overwhelmingly to support me were those cops. And because the interesting thing was, we all had the same story.
That's so interesting.
Some of these cops had come on to the police department in the mid to late 1980s. And back then, it was the story was very similar, where the cops didn't feel that, you know, black people should be on the police department, that Hispanic people belonged in the police department, that women did not, you know, they should not be cops because physically they're not going to be able to handle it. You know, my partner, the main partner I had for almost 5 years was a woman. And she was tough as nails. She kicked ass. You know, yeah. I felt twice as secure with working with her than I did with half the male cops in the precinct, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, so it had nothing to do with, you know, yeah, physically, were there times where she was outmatched by, you know, someone larger than her? Yeah. And then, you know, and that's, so we worked well together that way. And ideally, you know, we drove around all day and fought over men. So that presented an interesting dynamic in the car because, right. you know, she would think we're dealing with someone who's a straight guy and she might be able to get a date out of it. And I'd be like, I don't think so.
There's a sitcom right there.
Yeah.
Two partners.
All blue balls.
Know, like a police, you know, police grinders. It's like, you know. But that's kind of the mentality of police of old, and I think, again, not that it's perfect now. It's not all lollipops and you know, and bunny rabbits, but it's, you know, but I think it has come a long way. I tried to make it a point with the time that I was there to make substantive changes, at least particularly when it came to the LGBT communities, especially the transgender community. They, you know, in 2008, just to give you another perspective, I was fielding a number of complaints about how cops were treating people in the LGBT community. So I went to my chief about it, and I was kind of like the squeaky wheel. And he said, what do you think the problem is? I said, well, I think the problem is a training issue. I think we need to bolster and update and upgrade our training. He said, okay, well, go talk to the deputy commissioner of training. I said, okay, fine. So I did. So with the deputy commissioner training at the time, I convened a work group of about a dozen different LGBT organizations from all five boroughs of the city, including the ACLU and including Amnesty International. Now, both these groups in particular historically have always cracked heads with the police department over a myriad of issues. But here I had them sitting at a table with a dozen different agencies, the LGBT Center, the Anti-Violence Project, the Transgender Law Center, you know, all these different groups from all five boroughs, and it was heavily built in with a lot of transgender influence because we didn't have any policy or procedure to deal with the transgender community.
Right.
And, you know, I knew that there were other police departments around the country that either already did have something in the works Or we're working on something. And I said, you know, and it's an embarrassment. The NYPD should be ahead of the curve, not behind the curve with anybody. Especially for the fact that we have the largest transgender community and the largest LGBT community this side of the Rockies.
It's true.
If not in the country. So it's embarrassing, almost. You know, and long story short, we that group, that work group, took the 3 pages of LGBT reading that the Academy had at the time, and over a six-month period turned it into 3 dozen pages. And 90% of it was written by them. And then what happened as a result of that work group was that we formed a second work group to specifically address the patrol guide and to start to insert words in the patrol guide like transgender, gender identity, transsexual, you know, to change policies on how people in the transgender community were going to be searched, who was going to search them, where they were going to be housed, what cell were they going to go in, what bathroom were they going to use. You know, so these things were, you know, and again, that took 4 years to accomplish.
I mean, that right there is something that, okay, like I've talked to, you know, just like in general, like a lot of transgender and LGBT people on just on this podcast alone, that little like thing you just kind of like casually passed it, like what bathroom, what this, what, like, is something I would never think of. You
who's,
know, like
who's going to search them? Yeah.
Who's going to search them? That, like, yeah. To me, that's absolutely like fascinating. Like almost putting it into like a protocol. Like how do you go about that? I mean, that is something that, like, I think everyone should hear, like, because you are a voice that's not only speaking for the community, but you're also speaking for the police community, too. And it's, like, it's a very interesting dynamic just hearing you talk about that.
Well, it's interesting because what was, you know, for a year, well, this is what happened in New York City in 2002, Human Rights Commission law was amended, where all city agencies were supposed to treat people based on how they identify, not based on what their genitalia is. And I can't speak on behalf of the other agencies, but I know one agency that was not in compliance with that was the NYPD. And I'd been screaming about it for a long time, and yet it wasn't until they had multiple lawsuits from 2002 to 2008, including when the RNC was in town in 2004, was a huge lawsuit, which I had to go and testify. I had to go testify with the Corporation Council because I was now considered a resident expert, having done years and years of LGBT training, and now, you know, as the LGBT liaison. I had to go testify. And it was actually very easy. It was much easier than I thought because there's two focal points to that. One, do we have training to raise the level of awareness to our recruits and our cops as to the some insight into the LGBT community? And the answer is yes, because that was part of that revision and training. So I know we had it. Question number two is, well, what procedure do we have to address issues of gender identity and someone who's transgender? And I said, well, the answer to that is we have none. Hmm. Yeah, and of course, the one lawyer is looking at me like, oh my God, you just cost us a lot of money. You know, and I looked back at him with, I don't give a shit, because you made this. You know, you've not been, you know, you're not adhering to the law. And you know, so, and forget about the law for a second. You're not doing the right thing. You know, and that's what policing really at the baseline is. It's doing the right thing at the right time is what it comes down to. And, you know, if you in the patrol guide, just to kind of spell out what the patrol guide used to say, a male officer would search a male prisoner and a female officer would search a female prisoner. Hmm. That was the basic search policy. It didn't explain how you arrived at them being male or female. You know, and then it also doesn't explain what happened. It had no transgender language whatsoever or any language regarding gender identity.
It really is fascinating. It really is.
It was 50 years out of date.
Yeah.
You know? So, and just with the insertion of just some simple terms and using proper pronouns, you know, if I pull somebody over and you know, their ID says, you know, Tom Verney, but now, you know, that person's identifying as a female and they're saying, you know, well, my name is Teresa. The officers now should be addressing them as Teresa and using the pronoun ma'am or her or she, unless the person corrects them and prefers something otherwise. And then if they get arrested for some reason, then a female officer should ideally be doing the search. So that's the way it stands now. But prior to 2013, which is not that long ago.
No, I was just going to say not
right
at all.
Before you retired.
Yep.
Yeah, it literally took effect 6 months before I retired.
Was that procedure. Was that your
coup de grace?
Yeah, that was my swan song.
Yeah, your swan song?
Yeah. I was like, okay, you know, like, to be honest, I kind of wanted to see it through, and it was taking so long. I said, you know what, I might be 78 years old by the time this procedure gets done. Yeah, but it finally, it came through, and then, and to be honest, I was backing Bill Thompson for mayor in 2013. And when he lost the primary against de Blasio, I had no horse in the race at that point. So, you know, at that point, I had no horse in the race. I was coming up on 22 years of service. And I said, you know what? You just kind of get that tentative feeling of your stomach that it's maybe time to go. And I kind of felt like I did my bit for King Country, you know, and I would probably be able to do more, but not in that role and not being suffocated by the police department to some degree.
Well,
so.
It sounds like you did a lot before Jesus. Retirement, no. And even more, it sounds like after retirement. You mentioned training before and how someone asked you about it and you said the training wasn't there. I want to go back to training and police training as a general, not just for the LGBTQ community, but police training as a whole. Do you think, and please be completely honest, is 6 months enough to be a competent, well, like 100% well-rounded police officer? And what, because it seems like a lot of the issues coming from these high-profile stories that you mentioned before, like Ferguson and Tulsa and all these, Eric Garner and all this stuff in whatever, Florida, it really seems like it's a lack of training and a lack of ability to de-escalate a situation more than escalate it any further. And I have so many close friends. I mean, that I just got married 3 weeks ago, and I can't count how many police officers were at my wedding. Good friends of mine. And I don't want, you know. Yeah,
that's because the wedding took place in jail. See?
Oh, well, that's a joke.
That's a joke on his part. But but in all seriousness, you know.
At least it was cheap.
Yeah. if only. I wish.
Taxpayers covered that one, huh? Yeah. Thanks.
I'm still waiting for my.
Cocktail hour is great, though. Yeah,
I'm still waiting for my stipend. Cocktail fruit. but in all seriousness, you know, is police training where it needs to be? Is 6 months enough? And are these police officers who get into these situations where their only option is to, you know, kind of fire the gun and hope they don't get prosecuted, are they victims too? Or are they, you know, I kind of lean towards the side that they don't really have the training to succeed in that situation when there's something like the lady in Tulsa, or, you know, that's really the only one that stands out right now. What is your stance on that? If you can make one.
Yeah. I mean, it's 6 months, doesn't seem like a long time to train, right? You know, for someone to go and get 6 months worth of training and then suddenly be considered an expert in the field of law enforcement. Where else would you do that? You know, like, an associate's is 2 years, a bachelor's is 4, and, you know, so like...
A doctorate is 7.
Let me tell you, my associate's that took 2 years means absolutely nothing.
Right. Right. And really, exactly. but that's a good point in that, you know, the training is really what you make of it. The training, again, I went through 6 months of training, and I think I turned out pretty well. But,
great,
you know...
Yeah, great.
You know what I mean? But I think I did a fairly good job for the time I was there, and got promoted because of it. You know, right. So I was promoted to detective based on my work, and you know, so I only went through 6 months of training. Now, could I personally have used more training? Probably. I think the type of training and the quality of the training is what's important.
Right.
I think also the quality of the people that you have going through the training
yes.
is more important.
Yes, this is such an important point. Yes.
You know, so because what happens is you, again, when the training fails, you have to remember, recruits that go through a police academy, at least in a police academy like New York, they are as young as 21 years of age, and they are as old as potentially 40 years of age. The cutoff is 35, but if you have military experience, they add that on. So you could be 35, and let's say you had 6 years in the military, you could be 41 years old and going into, you know, the NYPD Academy, which is fine. I had recruits that were, you know, 39, 40, 41 years of age, and they were just fine. You know, totally stand-up people. They started off in a different career and decided to make a career change, and, you know, it's a lot harder to do when you're 40 versus 20, or 21. But the issue is you have people coming in with two or three or four decades worth of socialization already built into them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They've been socialized to believe, as we talked about before, all the wonderful things that are taught to us in our country. What the academy tries to do is to try to basically re-socialize them in 6 months.
That's a really interesting point. You know,
yeah, it's almost,
you don't think about that, like, that background, like that three, like you said, three decades of background built upon them or in them.
Yeah, I came into the police academy, I was 22, 23 years old. Okay, and I came in with over two decades worth of socialization that I had grew up around, you know, the neighborhood I grew up in, the family I grew up in, the schools I went to, and all that good stuff that makes you the person that you are. And then the academy had to, you know, like everyone else, they kind of treat you with a blank page. Mm-hmm. They treat everyone the same. So regardless of where you are in life, you could be the most racist person. You might be the most idealistic person and treated everyone completely fairly, regardless of who they are and what they look like or where they came from. But it doesn't matter. You're going to get the same treatment in the academy. They're going to treat you as if you maybe have some, you know, bad wiring. And they're going to try to re-socialize you in 6 months to at least for 8.5 or 10 or 12 hours a day while you're in uniform, you're out there doing the job, to act the way the police department wants you to act. And that is in a completely professional manner, respecting people, being courteous. You know, like what you see on the side of the police cars, on the NYPD cars, you know, that CPR. And that's put there on purpose, not so much for the public, but really for the cops as a reminder that when they walk into the car, oh, yeah, I need to be courteous, professional, and respectful to people, if that wasn't in their mindset when they walked in there. So, and they have 6 months to do that. And I think by and large, it's very effective. Having said that, you know, again, there are, we could probably talk all night long about cases that we've seen where maybe that training either did not adhere 100%, somewhere along the lines that training was discarded, somewhere along the lines that person chose, because it's a choice, to, you know, enter a situation with a certain mindset that, you know, I'm going to teach this person a lesson. You know, they're going to listen to me because I'm the police. That's why. Mm-hmm. You know, that shit doesn't fly, especially not in 2016, you know, going into 2017. That doesn't fly anymore. You know, you have to, if you're giving a legitimate lawful order to, you know, for someone to do something and that person's not doing it, there is a progression. There is a use of force progression, which they're trained to do, and if you go on the FBI website, I think they still have a graphic of it, you know, the use of force. Right. And, you know, that's what they're supposed to use, and what happens sometimes is some police at this day and age feel that they need to jump to a certain level of force instead of attempting to de-escalate the situation verbally, and they may just jump right to physical force, they may jump to using a taser, they may jump to using a firearm. The higher force you jump to, the higher level of force that you jump to, it's harder to back down from that. So ideally, you want them to kind of go step by step by step. You know, having also, however, there are a number of cases, and this happened to me personally, where there are a number of people in society that don't like to listen to the police, you know, and they talk back to the police in a way that is, you know, really escalates. Nasty.
Yeah.
That's actually, you know, me, Tom. I haven't been listening at all to this whole interview.
Right, yeah, exactly. See, case
he was sleeping, you know, before.
That's Perfect, I have it. So, you know, so and that's what the police are dealing with. They're dealing with society, some people in society. Now, I like to speak in absolutes, but there are some people in society that, listen, they like to test the cops. They like to get in their face. They like to get all up in their grill with their iPhone and you know, tape everything that they're doing and, you know, kind of get them agitated. Mm-hmm. That's, you're not going to win that battle down the street.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're going to piss off a cop because you're just purposely seeing what their threshold is of patience, I don't recommend that to people. You know, I want people to have a leap of faith and call the police if they have an issue. Let the police come and do their job. If the police do not do their job the way that they should or the way that you feel that they should, I have no problem with someone, you know, making a complaint, going to the precinct, talking to the captain, you know, calling up, you know, a civilian complaint review board if they have one, going to the district attorney's office, you know, going to the U.S. attorney's office, the Department of Justice. There are so many different levels of checks and balances.
President Trump.
Police have to
go to Trump. Go to him directly.
Yeah, well, listen, he's going to make America great again, so you may as well go to him while you're at it.
All right. So, okay, Tom, we're back. So, Tom, like, you, I could bring you on the cast like 10 times just to talk about different things, but I know you have a CNN interview tonight. So, before you get...
Yeah, I got to start getting...
I was just
trying to make myself look pretty somehow.
Before you get out of here, first off, I want to say that you are... I really think you're a voice that needs to be heard in many different communities, whether it's the police community, whether it's the LGBTQ community, whether it's the... just the average person who goes about their life and doesn't really know you, you even just like, I thought I knew a lot about you, but some of the points you bring up, like I've never sat down and thought about in my entire life.
Especially the anti-police community could use listening to what you have to say and your insight, because they think they know everything too. And you know what? It's a harder job than you think. And you kind of have to look at it from both sides before you make an opinion. And even then your opinion might not be 100% accurate. So he's right. I could pick your brain all night.
Definitely. So Tom, there's two last things I want to ask you. The first one, we'd be remiss if there was a photo of you where you proposed to your partner in the West Village that went super viral. And I think it's, I mean, I look at that photo and the first thing that comes to my mind is that World War II photo. But like, oh my God, we you know, when they come back from the war and it's the Navy guy.
Yeah, yeah, Times
Navy,
Square.
Yeah, exactly. The Navy guy kissing whatever you want to call her, the nurse, or I forget what she was.
Uh-huh.
But it's that, to me, it's a photo that is as impactful as that, but it also represents like the times. And you propose to your partner, Joe. I don't know anything about. I don't know Joe, obviously, but that photo speaks so much. It's one of those photos that speaks 10,000, a million words. You know, like it's powerful. Can you tell us just a little bit about that, when that happened? And then I have one more question, then we'll get out of here.
Yeah, it's so that happened. There was a rally at the Stonewall, on the block of the Stonewall in Barr. This was when Edie Windsor had her case, when DOMA was repealed. And we were together about 2.5 years at that point. I had been considering proposing. And, you know, it was just one of those things where the time was, it just kind of
swept
at the right time, you know. And you know, considering that we were talking about, you know, Edie Windsor, you know, another, you know, complete hero, fighting for equal rights, and she was there. I was with her and whatnot. So the actual rally, the official rally where they had speakers and whatnot, had just broken up, and so now we were able to finally take a break and go get something to eat and whatnot. So he was there. He was attending. He works for Cindy Lauper's True Colors Fund.
Nice.
Which is a nonprofit organization to address the needs of LGBTQ homeless youth nationwide. And so he was there. He got off work and came down to the rally. And, you know, so I told my sergeant, I said, hey, do me a favor, take a picture of me and Joe with the Stonewall in the background and with the big crowd and all, which he did. So she started taking the picture. She took the picture, and then at one point, and then I had gotten down on one knee and then to propose, and she just kept taking pictures. And she got that picture. She didn't realize she actually just kept snapping, like, and I had like 40 pictures on
like
it.
Like a smart woman would. Just keep taking pictures.
Yeah, she was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And then I posted the picture. I don't know where I initially posted. I think it was on my Facebook or maybe Twitter.
One says June 28th, 2013. Is that correct? I don't know.
Yes, that is correct.
Right.
So I posted it, and then it went, and then other people reposted it, and then it went nuts, and then it just went all over the place. And ironically enough, I actually got in trouble for that, believe it or not.
It doesn't sound that ironic.
Check this out. So someone called Internal Affairs and said that they were offended by the picture.
That was me. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I knew it.
I rethought it. I'm not offended anymore.
He's offended it wasn't him.
Right, exactly. So now I get a call from... Every unit in the NYPD has their own in-house integrity control officer. It's usually a lieutenant. So I get a call from my lieutenant a couple days... it wasn't even a couple days. It may have been a couple weeks after this, and he says, I know you were at a detail down in the village and you proposed to your partner and whatnot. I says, yeah. And he goes, well, someone filed a complaint with Internal Affairs that they were offended by you doing that, that a male officer should not be in uniform proposing to another male. So I said, oh, well, that's interesting. I said, because there are male heterosexual cops that propose to their female.
Right. All the time.
So I said, so what of it? And they said, well, you know, there is technically a procedure that states that, you know, while in uniform, there's a certain code of conduct. And I said, okay, well, I didn't strip him down and mount him in the middle of the street. You know what I mean? That's not what went down there. That was maybe the other pictures afterwards.
We don't got to talk about those pictures yet. Yeah, just yet. That next time you come on,
those
cast.
Haven't surfaced.
Like those are the Anthony Weiner pictures to come out later. You know, but I said what about what I did would be considered unprofessional when there are male straight cops doing this to their girlfriends all the time? Parades, they graduate at the academy. You see this in the news all the time. And he's like, well, I guess I never really thought about it that way. I'm like, oh, exactly.
Of course.
No. So I said, but then he turned around and says, well, what if a guy and his wife were walking down the street with a couple of kids? You know, how would they explain that to their children? I said, well, personally, I don't give a rat's ass how they explain that to their children.
Explain exactly what's happening. That's it.
It's not really my problem.
Yeah, they can explain, like, that's a police officer proposing to his partner.
Exactly. That's it. Don't lie to your kids. That's exactly what it is. Right. Don't lie to them.
Don't overthink it. Yeah, it's exactly. So simple.
It is what it is. It's not, you know, it's not rocket science. They may feel because of their religion or this and that, it's not pop. I says, I don't care what their
yuck.
Feeling is.
Yuck and more
I'm
yuck.
Not responsible. Yeah. I'm not responsible for their homophobia. Sorry. You know, I said, because of the fact that for decades and decades and decades, and occasionally this will happen with female cops proposing to their boyfriends, but overwhelming the majority of the cops that have done that are male straight cops that have proposed to their girlfriends. I said, I am not aware of an instance where a male straight cop proposing to their girlfriend resulted in them being punished in some way. And if anything, the news reports it. It's on
the Daily
News or the Post or, you know, it's on Channel 5 News or, you know, NBC. I said, so if you can show me on paper all these cops that have been disciplined in some way, that have proposed to their male cops, male straight cops, that have proposed to their girlfriends, have been disciplined, and you feel that I deserve that same level of discipline, then so be it. I says, I would be shocked if you found one instance where a male straight cop has been disciplined for proposing to their girlfriend.
Never. Never. No way.
And if I am going to be disciplined for doing the same thing that they've been doing for eons, then I just want to know if that's what we're talking about here, because I have to make a phone call.
Rules. Yeah, yeah.
Because my first phone call is going to be to my union, and the second phone call is going to be to the highest paid lawyer, civil rights attorney in New York City, and I'm going to be mounting the largest lawsuit you've ever seen against this police department.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Make me a rich man, because I have a wedding to plan for. So you know what I mean.
Tom, first of all, like I said, I'm not even kidding. Man, that photo does instill a certain sense of feeling. You know, it does. I don't know. You look at that. I compared it to that sailor photo. It does have this little nostalgia. Not nostalgia. I guess it's not nostalgia when it's so new. But there's a movement kind of photo. Something that I think 100 years from now, someone might look at that and be like, wow, you know. I got a question, though, for you. Who did you have to pay for the ring yourself?
Pay for the ring?
Yeah, the whole ring.
No, we didn't. We paid for our own rings.
See, that's why I need to get gay married.
I was gonna say that was a step above. When you dance who leads.
See, that's a great 50-50. We buy it together. See, it's already the relationship's already ahead. You know, you're in it 50-50. I'm just kidding.
We didn't even have an actual wedding. We went down to City Hall and got married. Just one day we went down there with one of my friends who was a witness. And
smart.
Good for you, brother.
Matter of fact, we just passed our first anniversary.
There you go.
October.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
So thank you. It's so we're no longer newlyweds, but but yeah, I mean, we'd like to have a wedding, an actual, not maybe a redoing of the vows, but then really just more of a party.
A party, exactly.
Just to kind of solidify the event and.
Yeah,
and just to get people that we care about to come and have a good time and
celebrate your union.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to everybody else's wedding. It's only fair, but it's unbelievably expensive, as you probably know.
Yeah, I know, and it was a waste.
I know it too.
Yeah, but Tom, last question, and you don't have to get super crazy into it because I know you got to go. With the Trump presidency, as a first off, you're a member of something he supports and advocates, the police department and government workers, but you're also something that a lot of LGBT people are fearful of. So you have a foot in both sides of this Trump presidency. Are you worried at all, or are you in the we were kind of talking before, we're kind of wait and see what happens, kind of supporting it and hopefully it doesn't go massively wrong, but you seem to have, you have a lot of interest in this, or you should anyway. Yeah. The last thing you.
Well, that's actually what we'll be talking about tonight on CNN.
So you say I broke the story before CNN.
I could not have guessed that's what CNN was going to be asking you.
So you're saying Verbal Shenanigans News Network was more effective than CNN, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
feel free to say on here what you would not say on there, honestly. And then, that's honest. That's honest.
Yeah. No, I quite frankly, I was kind of hoping that Joe Biden was going to run. That's who I personally wanted. And I felt that he could have won.
Side note, Joe Biden, Obama memes, funniest thing ever. Best. But
Oh, they're awesome. and I believe most of them are true.
Yeah. 100% accurate. Yeah.
They're actually just straight from the stenographer that was in the room.
No, but exactly. Right from the horse's mouth. No, I felt that my personal feeling was that Joe Biden was completely qualified for the job, having sat there for 8 years, one heartbeat away from it. And I think that it's a shame that he did not that he chose to kind of back off it. There are arguments that, the child was promised to Hillary and, the DNC and, Debbie Wasserman Schultz already kind of promised it to her, and the fix was in, so you had no choice but to have her as a candidate if you were a Democrat. So, I met Hillary Clinton in 2006, when she was a senator and during the gay pride parade, as a matter of fact. and actually had a conversation with her.
Were you working or attending?
I was working.
Wow.
She joined in the parade at the front of the parade where the dignitaries generally are, and I was walking, and that's where I happened to be at the time, and she jumped in with her her crew. And I actually had a very honest conversation with her because she was very taken aback by the response walking down the street towards the end of the parade, and everyone was, you know, screaming, "Oh, Hillary!" This is 2006, you know, and so the 2000 she was
right. 2 years before Barack Obama.
She hadn't said that she was going to run in 2008 at that point. Yeah. But everyone was like, "Oh, run for president, run for president." And she was like, "Oh my God, wow, I didn't expect this kind of response." So I told her, I says, "Well, why don't you?" I said, "It's not like you're not qualified." Even at that point, she was qualified, I felt. But I said, "You know, you lived there for 8 years. I mean, so you kind of know what's going on there. You have a pretty good, you know, lay of the land." And I think, and this is, mind you, June of 2006, where no one had really thrown their hat in the ring yet. So I said, listen, what do you got to lose? You know, run for it, and, you know, if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, then c'est la vie. So, you know, and then we all know how that turned out in 2008. So, you know, this time around, however, I was not as much of an ardent supporter of her. Joe Biden was kind of like my guy, and then when he chose not to run, I actually kind of flipped to the Republican side, and I was kind of going for John Kasich.
Okay.
To the dismay of a lot of friends of mine,
who were
heavy
sure.
on Hillary.
Yeah,
and you know, because I'll tell you what, John Kasich is, you know, he's your classic, he's a classic Republican, he's more of a moderate, he claims to be conservative, but he's really a moderate. He came out and said, you know, I my view on same-sex marriage is that I believe in traditional marriage. However, I would not do anything to overturn that, because the Supreme Court has ruled.
Right.
So I appreciated that. And I said, okay, listen, at least I know where he's coming from. Where, you know, because look, Hillary and Obama both did not support marriage equality until it was politically.
Yeah, they evolved. You know, they evolved on it. Yep. They evolved on it.
Right. And you know what? I don't, whether it was personal or political, I don't care, right. Quite frankly. I would have liked it to have been personal, you know,
from the heart, versus political. From the heart. Yeah.
Yeah, because at least you're coming from it, you know, that it's mm-hmm. it's you're doing some soul searching and you know, legitimately evolve versus, oh, you know what, I may lose votes, so let me evolve now. But you know what, either way, they both evolved, so to speak, and they were both behind marriage equality, and that helped push it through, I think, which is fine. I'm happy with that. The issue now is that, you know, I've accepted Trump as the new president. I'm not out there protesting, thinking that,
nope.
you know, perhaps it's going to change. I'm not out there saying, you know what, my guy didn't win. I'm really upset.
You're not. Are you wearing safety pins?
Yeah, no, I'm not wearing a safety pin, except on the diapers I wear.
Yeah. You're not that old
which
yet.
Which is a conversation for another day. But,
yep.
You know, it is what it is. At this point, I think, you know, Trump is, it looks like he's the guy, right? So mm-hmm. we're going to have to, and I know some of my friends who are Republican are saying, well, you know, wishing Trump to fail is like wishing the pilot on your plane to fail, and then the plane crashes. So right. I said, well, I don't want that to happen. If Trump is the pilot and Pence is the co-pilot, what I'm hoping is that I don't want them to fail. I want them to succeed, because if they succeed, the country succeeds. However, I also don't want to be thrown out of that plane without a parachute.
Yeah,
I wouldn't mind them doing like a Lost type of scenario. Like, just go away for a while.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Castaway.
Yeah.
So I'm more concerned about Pence than I am about Trump.
I agree 100% on that.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, the bottom line is here is that, you know, and this is where I tried to make some inroads with my Republican friends who don't understand why people are protesting. I have no problem with people protesting. I think they should be out there venting, and because we all know that this election was just completely off the rails from minute one.
I thought it was civil and organized, and I think the best candidate won, who put the best argument forward.
Mm. Right, and you know what? Look,
most adults.
And I don't know what alternate universe you've been living in, but
New Jersey.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. Well, there's a lot of things that's different in Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, when it came down to it at the end, I think Hillary did not run the best campaign she could have. I think she picked a weak
I agree.
Vice president pick. I think she had a lot, you know, more baggage than a Samsonite store. And at the end of the day, she had unbelievable high levels of negatives. So did he.
Agreed.
Okay. She was, you know, found to be untrustworthy by a number of people, Bernie supporters and Trump supporters. And her integrity was called into question. So was his. In my opinion, I think if you were looking at the lesser of two evils scenario, I think she should have won based on experience, because she had a shitload of experience. I don't know if I can say that on the show, but I apologize for my vulgarity. But
you can say whenever you want.
Yeah. Her experience completely outweighed his. You know why? Because he has none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're going based on who can walk into the office tomorrow and do the job and hit the ground running, the answer is her.
Right.
Realistically. Now, you know, can he do the job? Oh, God, I hope so. Because if not, we're in a lot of trouble. The problem is that he's going to be heavily influenced by Pence, who's going to be the most powerful vice president since Cheney, and we know how that all turned out.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking before. I think one of the things you have to hope at this point, I am no, by the way, I'm not a Democrat nor a Republican, but I think at this point you have to hope that Trump was just spewing, you know, whatever was riling the crowds up to get in the vote, and then hopefully he'll be open-minded now in his presidency and you know, be open to what's working and what's not, and hopefully it's not just a complete takeover by the wrong side and influenced by the,
exactly.
You know, that's the only thing you can hope for if you are not a Trump supporter. You have to hope that he was just getting in there, and he's in there now, and now things are going to kind of shake out a little bit.
And I'm wondering, as a member of, the LGBTQ, a lot of friends and people that I know who are members of the LGBTQ community, they are scared, and they're worried that he's going to appoint someone to the Supreme Court, and they're going to overturn gay marriage and all this stuff, and all their rights are going to be taken away. And he was on 60 Minutes, and he said he's not going to do that. And do you think there's any validity to that, or do you think it's kind of, you know, kind of just people reacting to the election, and there's really nothing to worry about there, at least as far as that one right. Maybe some other rights are up in question, but that one that affects you the most.
Well, if you remember when Obama won the first time, what was the big complaint from the right?
Yeah. That he was black.
Yeah.
That was
socialist.
Yeah, that was the real complaint.
No, I mean, the big complaint from Republicans and at least people on the right was that, oh, he's coming to take our guns. He's going to come and take our guns.
Socialist.
Yeah, 8 years later, I don't think he's taking anybody's guns.
No.
I think gun sales went through the roof, and I think they're doing just fine. But, you know, here, I think the LGBTQ community has a legitimate concern, because while, you know, with Obama, you know, people thinking they were going to come take his guns, that was all, you know.
He never said it.
Right. Well, first of all, he never said it, number one. Number two, that was their perception, largely based on myth and based on, you know, no facts whatsoever. Here, we have a vice president who has a track record of legislating against the LGBT community in his own state.
Right.
That, if the handwriting was never on the wall before, well, it's sure on the wall now, isn't it? And the fact they're going to be picking at, certainly at least one. You know, the notorious, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I don't know how much life she's got left.
She's 83,
her. So that could be two.
She needs to live forever.
And then possibly three. That could shift the court and really tremendously.
Yeah.
And that shift will be for a long time
decades,
to come.
Decades.
Now, I, because the Supreme Court has already, you know, ruled on marriage equality, do I would hope that they're not going to overturn it and now make my marriage invalid.
Right.
And I'll be the first one out there fighting for it if it happened, or if it has any you know, teeth to it. But, you know, and that's like also saying, you know, well, you know, they've been talking about overturning Roe versus Wade for 40 years as well. So
that scares me.
I said the same thing before. Even the most staunch conservatives on the Supreme Court, they're not just going to overturn that, like, just because they feel like it. That's a big decision on their part. That, you know, like, that's not just something that they're none of them are confident in that decision, I think, these days. That's my opinion. You know, I could be proven wrong, and I hope I'm not, but, and I'm hope I'm wrong about the, the gay marriage thing too, because, you know, you guys fought for those rights really hard, and it would be a shame just because one guy gets in office that everything is taken away, that and you'd have to fight again. But I really hope I'm wrong about that.
Oh, so am I. But, you know, I mean, here is, I would hope that Trump, well, let's put it this way. First of all, Trump's going into office as, if I think, the oldest president
yes.
when he takes office.
Ever.
If I'm
ever.
Not mistaken.
In history.
Yep. Oldest. Yep.
So now, while he seems like he's in fairly good shape, the reality is that you now have the most stressful job of anyone on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And at that age, I know at 47, I would be pretty stressed the F out. And at 70, I would think that the ramifications of that are probably even greater. So, yeah, here you have a vice president one heartbeat away from the big chair,
right.
who already has an agenda against the LGBT community. And that's why people are freaking the F out, because right. he has an agenda.
It's not nope. Trump. It's if Trump doesn't, if it's Trump goes somewhere. Right.
Now, right. So if Trump either gets.
That's a good point.
Let's say if he gets impeached, you know, people are saying, oh, well, he might be impeached before he even takes office or afterwards. Okay, so if he gets either locked up, if he gets impeached, if he decides, you know what, after a year or two, you know what, I'm sick of this, I'm going to resign,
right.
you know, or he drops dead, then Pence takes over.
Yeah.
And now you have a guy who has a clear agenda against the LGBT community, who, if he's already done that in one state, why would he not want to push that agenda nationwide? And if he's going to have some influence with a Republican House and Senate to appoint people to the Supreme Court that are going to help push that agenda, why the hell not? So, you know, he's not going to be able to do it by an executive order, you know, so he's going to need the Supreme Court, but he's going to have influence over Supreme Court appointees. And then, you know, you would imagine that, at least for the short term, you know, if the Republican Party can get together and, you know, if they're going to rubber stamp some of what he's going to do, that's a rubber stamp you don't need.
Right.
Then we're really behind the eight ball.
That's
so. Yeah, you know, I tell people, listen,
right.
go and protest. You know, in the here and now, you know, we can accept Trump for the fact that he's the president. Some people are like, oh, I'm never accepting him, and I'm going to get a tattoo on my ass that says so. Okay.
How'd you see my tattoo?
You know, that's
no.
fine. Listen, I think that's money that would be better spent on candy, but, you know, who might say.
Yeah.
You know, but
or beer.
He's, you know, I've accepted him as the incoming president. Quite frankly, I would love to get involved in that administration somehow to make sure that I could be a voice heard in there.
You should.
Please,
100%.
Please do whatever you can to get in there.
Yeah, they haven't rang my bell yet to do that, so we'll see. I'm hoping that at some point I can, you know, whether CNN doesn't get me on board as an analyst or SiriusXM doesn't get me on my own show, then. At some point, I'm going to have my voice out there to make sure that, you know, all the progress that's been made is not undone.
Tom,
at least not on my watch.
Yeah,
Tom, you, I want to get you out of here. You are probably, if not the most important voice I've had on this episode, on this podcast. I have 128 episodes or whatever it was, interviewed people all around the world. Just to hear your voice and the way you stand by and the way you break every stereotype that's out there with the gay community, comp community. You're breaking stereotypes left and right, and it's amazing to hear. And I 100% support you with whatever you're going to do. So go crush CNN tonight. If people want to check you out or send you a message, if they hear this or they learn about you and want to find out more, where should they go?
They can go. It's probably the easiest thing is go to offbeatcop.com. They can check out the blogs there. They can opine on them and agree, disagree, call me names, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. They can email me through the site. And then on Twitter, it's at Tom Verney, TOMVERNI.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on. And I wish you the best of luck
man.
In the future. And
I'll
definitely be following you.
The opportunity.
Absolutely. I'd love to get you back on soon, too, like maybe a couple months here, like what's going
yep.
on and what you got going on. A
couple months into Trump's
yep.
presidency.
I'm sure by that point we'll have more to talk about once his transition of power takes place. So
absolutely.
Yep.
All right. Tom Verney, Steve Aspera. Tom Verney.
What a guy, man.
I mean, to me, like I even told him – the audience won't hear, but I said, We were like, normally our interviews are 30 minutes and 40 minutes ish, you know, like, and he was a guy who didn't like want to stop. He just kept going. And I feel like, and I'm dead serious when I told him it wasn't just kissing his ass. He has a voice that should be heard. Yeah, well, it combines so many communities or can really change the view of different right. communities. Like you said, like the anti-police thing, people should hear that.
Exactly. You know? It's because he, I guess because of his unique situation, he can put himself in a bunch of different shoes and he can put himself in a bunch of different situations to the point where, like, you know what? There is not just one way to look at every issue. I mean, in fact, there's multiple ways to look at any issue, and he is proof of it, and he articulates it so well that you gotta just hear him out.
Let's just look at it on the surface. He's a cop that, let's say it like it is, he sounds like your everyday kind of dude.
Exactly.
If I told you that guy was like gay, you'd be like, even everyone would be like, really? That
episode of Entourage, yeah. Drama, it's like, no way. You know, he didn't know he was gay until he tried to bang him.
I mean,
it's
that, like, what? Not that you would have a problem with you, but your first reaction might be, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, but he's a cop, which is already those two things.
I knew a little bit about him going into the interview because I'd see, you see him on CNN.
What's even funnier is, like, it was just supposed to be us tonight, and I, like, text you, hey, we got a guest tonight that I've been working with for a while.
Not to know that, but... The most interesting part of the interview for me was when he said he was outed, like, a year into being a cop.
Me too. I was thinking the same thing. 22 years.
Get out of here. I had so many questions about that situation, but it's just so.
Well, that was one of the reasons I asked him what year it was too. Yeah. 1993. That happened. That Think was a different that. Era, man.
I was nine.
I was a kid. Yeah. I'll admit it. When up until about high school, I thought, like, I don't know. I didn't know any gay people. Like, really, until high school, I knew a couple, and then it started to become an issue. And I had an English professor who actually was the first one who ever. I'll never forget him. Mr. Strack, his name was first one who ever even, like, talked about it, like, normal, like, cat, like. In a class setting, like, and, like, I had thought, I'll admit it, I thought, like, you were born with a blah, blah. And then, like, by junior, senior year, I knew I was an idiot, you know?
Yeah, just the fact
not everyone
that,
grows
just
up.
Just the fact that he joined the force, and he was gay, and he tried to keep it quiet. And the fact that he got outed by, like, an asshole cop. Like, the cop wanted to make it about him, and people came and stood up for him, and the fact that he said that the first people by his side were black cops, Latino cops, women cops. That is, if that is not, like, the most interesting thing, or, like, something that, like, you can hang your hat on, just, like, you know what, there's a lot more going on inside police departments besides whatever you think it is, racism or like, whatever you think goes on inside police departments, there is so much more, and there is so much more of a human element to it that it really should give you a second opinion on everything, you know? And everyone knows someone like that or someone that has a story like that, and it's not something to be taken lightly.
And I think it's just life itself. Like, your opinion should always be altering and changing. They should never be this one stagnant thing that stays the same way forever.
Concrete.
Like, they should always be, evolving. They should always be evolving. Like, when, like, a new scenario is thrown your way, you learn how to deal with it and take the good with the bad or whatever you think it is, and evolving your own opinion. You should never be like, I have the same opinion as I did 15 years. Really? Because I don't believe you. If you have the same exact opinions you had 15 years ago.
I wonder, and I
used to think Miller High Life was one of the best beers ever. Exactly. You know?
It's like how foolish you were.
Yeah.
I wonder, and I tried to ask this in the question, but there's no way to answer it. So there was no point in even asking. But I wonder how different of a guy he would have been if he wasn't outed. If he got to come out on his own terms. I wonder how different of a
I like that question,
or
because
how different of a cop he would have been if he got to come out on his own terms, maybe after retirement or maybe later, in not in 1993, in 2003 when he was on the force for 10 years as opposed to 1 year. I wonder how different he would have turned out as a cop, as a community liaison, as a political commentary. Yeah. Like,
you also wonder
there's so many questions.
You also wonder if, for instance, like if he didn't come out, if he would have suppressed it more.
Yes.
Like,
if
you know,
he would have been a worse.
Yeah,
yes.
Worse.
Yeah.
It would have went the other way.
See, like, there's
you know?
A million angles to play, and the fact that it played out as it did, he turned out, I think, as one of the great voices for police community relations in the country, you know, LGBTQ, yep, all that stuff. I felt embarrassed saying this on him. I don't know what the Q stands for in LGBTQ.
Queer.
Well, there's lesbian, bisexual, gay, transsexual, and queer.
Yeah.
But I thought queer was covered in...
Is that you just gotta get covered in
I didn't know, and I feel ignorant.
Questionable?
Question. No, that's what Taylor Hall was before the Devils game tonight. He's not playing. But I didn't know that queer was not covered in LGBT. What is... Yeah. I didn't know, but I felt weird asking that. But
here's the thing, like... there's one of these episodes. It's going to be about 3 hours long because I don't want to cut a minute out of it. I don't. I almost feel yeah, guilty talking about my vacation in Sedona and then being like, here's a guy who has a voice that's so important. So
can you believe I was too fat to fit on a mule? Yeah. By the way, here's one of pioneer. Yeah. Here's one of a great American hero.
I'm almost about to chop out the two and make them two different episodes. I'm feeling relaxed, and actually both of us got back from trips. I just got back from Arizona and did the Grand Canyon, did Sedona. We'll talk about that in a second. I did a little bit of Scottsdale and Phoenix, which we were just talking about. And you're still married. You let the wedding happened after that, even after that episode.
Uncle Julio didn't show up, or whatever it was.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Move on and carry on.
So you came back from Hawaii.
Yes.
How long were you there?
We went to Oahu for 4 days and Maui for 6 days, and travel is about a whole day there and back. Yeah. So you say 11 days, but it was really 10.
That's nice. Days, yeah. When you get like great, longer than a week, that's nice. You get to like settle in a little bit. And
it was so great, man.
So you do anything crazy there? You do,
we did some crazy stuff. Oahu. We stayed in Waikiki in Oahu. Oh, easy.
Come here, buddy. Get in for the good stuff.
Oahu is very tourist-centric. We stayed in Waikiki. There are so many tourists, a lot of people from Japan and China. And it rains a lot in Oahu. The way the island is shaped, the mountain, you know, mountains pretty much trap clouds in. So Oahu, every day we were there, it rained at some point. It didn't rain all day, but it was still nice. We stayed at nice Hilton, Crazy Village, Lagoon Tower, the nicest of the nice. We did a hike, Diamond Head hike. We went to Pearl Harbor.
Nice.
I had to do that. I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't do that. Pearl Harbor was...
That's why you had a problem with all the Japanese people that were there.
Yeah. During the movie, I kept looking over.
And Ben Affleck.
It was a sad, pretty sad experience to be there. It's very solemn, you know. I try to joke around and make the best out of everything, but when you're there, it's the workers joke around a little bit, but the people there, it's a very low energy.
I can't imagine that's going to P.T. Barnum Bailey Museum.
It wasn't the Dole Plantation, which we also did, the Dole Pineapple Plantation.
Really? Yeah. That's cool.
That was a lot of fun. And then we drove the island. We did the North Shore, went look at some surfers and stuff.
Dreamy.
Just watch them, wow.
Wow.
No, we'll just watch what they can do. Yeah. There was hardly any waves, but it was fun to just go and be there and see some cool towns. Maui was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Maui, 80 and sunny every day. We swam with sea turtles. We snorkeled and kayaked. We did, what else? I don't know. We did a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
A bunch of other stuff.
Now, is it as expensive as everyone says out there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's well, you know, Waikiki and Oahu, yeah, expensive. It's expensive to get there, and it's expensive to stay there. I'm sure there's, Uber was pretty cheap for the most part everywhere we went. But, yeah, I mean, if you're in a tourist trap place, which most people who go there are, they just jack the prices up.
Yeah. Well, then everything's imported, adds a couple bucks onto every single thing,
pretty much everything.
Gas, milk, whatever, whatever it is. Now, more importantly, what about the beer situation in Hawaii?
I'm glad you asked.
let's get the important things out. I'm sure the wife part was good, but let's talk about the important things.
So, Oahu has a couple breweries. I didn't get to visit any because we didn't have a car in Oahu.
Kona, right? Kona's over there?
Kona, I think, is on the Big Island. Kona is on Hawaii, in Kona. Oahu has Lanikai and some other breweries. I bought a couple bottles to drink. I bought three, one a day to drink there.
Yep.
There's a great great gastropub in like a half hour walk from downtown Waikiki called Real. Real, a gastropub is what it's called. And they actually were one of the hosts of Zwanzi Day. I don't know if you know what that is. Canteon.
Right.
Canteon Zwanzi Day. So this place had Canteon on tap.
Nice.
So I went there for lunch one day, had Canteon. I had never had a Canteon beer ever.
No.
I had it on tap. It was pretty crazy. That was cool. But that was pretty much it on Oahu. Maui Brewing Company is, I mean, I know they're not up and coming because they've been around for a while, but
legit.
The stuff that the people don't realize the stuff that they're doing because they send their flagship stuff to.
Right. Well, that happens a lot of places.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
exactly. The stuff that you make a lot of, you can, and you send it. Like, we're getting Coconut Porter and Bikini Blonde and whatever their flagship stuff is. The stuff that isn't their flagship is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Maui Brewing Company. They have a brew pub in Lahaina, and then their main brewery is in Kihei. I went to the brew pub twice and the brewery once.
Mm-hmm.
So overall in six days I went there three times. My first day there, oh man, it was such a ridiculous night, whatever. I won't get into it too much, but I spent a lot of money my first day there.
All right.
At the, I know I bought like a shirt and a double wall insulated growler. I bought like four flights. And my wife had to drive home that night.
Yeah, I was gonna say four flights will do it.
Well, they have Imperial Coconut Porter, which is the one that they can and send over here, but they make a double version of that. It's like 9%. It's almond joy in a glass. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And they had a ton of other beers that are just so good. They had a session, you know, like a Carton Boat,
yep.
Like that 4.2 hoppy session. You could drink a ton of. They make a very similar beer to that called Suck 'em Up. I drank
Suck 'em Up.
Suck 'em Up, yeah. Suck 'em Down, pretty much. Right. I drank a lot of that. I filled my growler twice with it the time I was there. And the growler works. It was in the sun all day, kept it cold as hell.
There you go. That's a good way to test the growler.
Yep.
That's
yeah.
A good way to break it in.
Fill it up, bring it by the pool, and just start filling cups up. Yep. And it worked. So the beer scene is, they're kind of spoiled over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think I'm starting to think almost everywhere you go, you could. If you take your time and you find where things are, it's there's something for everyone. I mean, so overall, Hawaii, awesome experience. I would love to get out there.
I'm hoping.
You're barking at the vacuum. My dog is barking at a vacuum cleaner and a mic stand.
Because he knows that vacuum gives him shit.
I get you back, Mom.
when you ain't expecting it. Yeah. I am hoping. I said to my wife when we were leaving the actual brewery, it's probably the nicest brewery I'll ever see in my life.
Mm-hmm.
It is so nice. They have like. I think they run like 70 or 80% of their energy is clean.
That's cool.
Solar panels everywhere. Just so nice. Like if you get the right day, you can see the ocean. Like it's just amazing. And I said when we were leaving, I was like, I really hope this is not the only time in my life that I come here.
Yeah.
I hope to go back. It's expensive. So. Yeah.
Well, I myself had a big week, brewery week, but also because last Saturday I went up to, you know, my favorite place to go up by Lake George, up in the Adirondacks, and I know I mentioned my favorite brewery, not because of the beer, just because of the times I've had there and the environment. And you're right out on the lake is Adirondack Brewing Company. And I think their beer is significantly catching up. Every time I go there, there's something new. They got these IPA programs where they're taking the same yeast from IPAs and keep transforming it into something. They got they're doing sours, barrel aged, and it's just a great place. They had a pumpkin chunkin' event where you were shooting allowed to bring pumpkins and shoot them at like pictures of Trump and pictures of Hillary, and it was just a good time overall. We went to that. We went to a brewery called Paradox Brewery. I'd never been there before. Wow. I tried their stuff. Very solid, so very heavy on the Northeast IPAs, but I had no problem with that. So they were good. And then on Wednesday, teachers' convention, so I left for the Grand Canyon, which. You said you've been there. It's just
yes.
Grand Canyon is a place where pictures do it absolutely no justice because it flattens everything.
Right.
The vast size, the fact that when you're at the top, you cannot see straight to the bottom. You can't see the river in some spots.
However big you think it is, it's bigger than that. Like you can imagine you couldn't even see the other side or whatever. When I went there, I remember thinking. It's bigger than I thought it was, and I was expecting massive.
Yeah.
It's so huge. Yeah.
So I got a couple funny stories. So we get there, and I'm like, I'll punish myself to get somewhere. Like I think I can drive for hours by myself in the dark. Like I'm a suck it up kind of guy.
It sounds like our vacations were more similar than we think.
So we get there 9:30 ish. Phoenix time, and I get to the rental car place. Now, it's a 3.5 hour drive, okay, from Phoenix to the Grand Canyon. So I'm already looking at 12, 1 o'clock, 1:30, you know. The rental car place is the slowest. There's three places, right, in a row, and I did Fox Rental Car.
Okay. I was going to guess Advantage.
The other two are flying by. People are getting their cars. There's like 20 of us in line, just one at a time. I mean, the guys are talking like, this is ridiculous. So an hour for the car. I'm getting the car, and I'm already feeling tired. But I'm not telling the girlfriend I'm that tired. I'm like, I got this. She's like, okay. You know, sleeps, mouth open, like have, you know. Sleeping like like a bear, you know?
Straight disrespect.
She's looking at me now like that didn't happen, but it's we made about 20 minutes into the desert and she's sleeping.
I believe him because it happened to me too. So.
Now this is – I wish it was daytime because the ride is awesome. It's like there's the landscape changes from desert to mountains to everything. So I'm getting there and it's like – now it's 75-mile-an-hour roads. And lately I've been noticing that like night driving, it's kind of been bothering my eyes lately, like especially when there's a lot of reflectors. Like I see kind of like halos almost. I'm like, well, this ain't good.
Yeah, no.
And I'm tired and people are like flying and there's like –
Sunday drivers.
And I get there, and we get to the road that like goes into the Grand Canyon, which is about a 50-mile drive. And I'm so tired. I have a water bottle. I'm squirting air and water into my face. Windows open. I found a couple podcasts I love, and I'm like, blast it. Like, I will tell you right now, if it was not for Bill Burr on this Joe Rogan podcast that I was listening to, I probably would have had to pull over to the side road. He woke me up. With,
that was great, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. The end of Bill Burr, side note, dominated that pod. He was the funniest guy.
Yeah, he's the king right now. By
leaps and bounds. Rogan, Stanhope, all of them had nothing. He dominated the whole show. Yeah. I was dying.
Pretty much every show he goes on, he dominates. Well,
that's true.
That's like...
So I'm getting there, right? And I'm driving down these... It's so dark. There's no other cars in the road. And this is about 1:30 at this point. So it's about 3:30 Eastern time, and I've been up since 6 o'clock because I can't sleep on planes. I got problems. Mm-hmm. My ears are killing me, all that stuff. But so I see, like, elk on the side of the road, and I'm like, oh, my God, elk. Like, they're huge, you know, they're bigger than deer. And now everything I see in my mind is an elk. You know, I'm like,
slowing down. You're doing, like, 40.
I'm hitting the rumble strips, and, like, girlfriend wakes up. She's like, huh, are we almost there? Like, why are you hitting the rumble strip so much? I'm like, shut up! I've been driving for 4 hours. You know, she's like all wide awake. I'm thinking I'm seeing that.
You need me to drive it all? No! No, I'm good.
I'll drive. No, you will not touch this steering wheel. You know, like, everything I see, I think, is an elk, you know. And finally, I get there. And, you know, we did end up safe. But that was a rough drive at that time of night. But so we wake up. I wanted to wake up in the Grand Canyon, like get the whole experience. Wake up at 6, 7, get up and go. So we go to do this hike. Now, first off, I go to like look at it right at the top, and I'm getting close, and she yells at me like, "Don't get close!" And her reaction is, "I'm going in the car." Like she thought I was just gonna fall into the canyon, and that was gonna be the end of our trip. Reaction to me is, "I'm going in the like." So one thing is like, if I did fall, she would have been in the car. Not knowing if I fell. So that was no help to me at all. And then she's giving me the worst looks right now. Just eat your dinner. So then we go on the hiking trail. We find a good hiking trail. And it walls up in the canyon. You might have even done the same one. Who knows? But the views are amazing. And she's like, that's not the trail. And she's like looking at the paved road. Like, that must be the trail. I'm like, no. This 4-foot wide trail is the trail. And it's just... unbelievable, the views. You know, you're going down and you know, it just winds and twists and you're excited, so going down is no problem.
Yeah, you can keep going. Go for 3 hours going down, right? Yeah, it's like, oh, let's go further. And then it's like you realize everything we just did we got to redo
and,
with gravity against us now. Yeah,
thin air, straight up basically. You know, you're not realizing all those steps they put in that you're going down to feel great.
Yeah.
You are all like being on a step machine for hours, you know?
Yeah.
So we went to a certain point. All around you see signs that say, if you're going down the river, make sure you seek advice from a park ranger. Because there's no water. There's no water stops.
People bring like one bottle of water for the day. It's like one little 16-ounce bottle. Mm-hmm. It's like that's a half hour. That's nothing. You need so much more water for that trip if you want to get to the bottom and then go back up.
Yeah. So we go down to it's probably like 2 miles down, but you know, it feels pretty significant. We're like, you know, we want to enjoy the rest of the day, so let's head back up. And I just realized on the way up, I realized, boy, I am not a professional hiker. I'm not, you know, like, if we went down 3-4 miles, it would have taken me a long, because I was taking breaks every 8 to 10 minutes, like, you know, sucking it up. And like, now Alex, she's an ultra runner, and she would take some breaks, but she was needing. But I'm like dying, you know, like I'm like every once in a while, I'm like, I gotta stop. I gotta catch my breath here, like. And then, like,
not to mention, she's well rested, as opposed to someone. She slept all night. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're tired. Yeah.
I'm on 2 hours sleep.
Yeah, powering through.
But just pouring, and it's amazing. Like, but I did get back up, obviously. But it was tough, and it's funny because like the last couple podcasts, I was talking about how I wanted to go on this mule ride, but I was too heavy for the mule. There was a weight limit, but we saw the mules, man. The path they go down, and them high up on the saddle.
Careful what you wish for.
It's not, crazy. Yeah. Great. Like, I would do it. I know I would. I know she would have backed out in seconds.
Yeah, because it's
crazy.
You can't control a mule. They don't speak English, yeah. So it's like if they're getting too close, if they get too close to the edge, you're just like, oh, you're trying to steer, but well, you know, you're on 2 feet, the way to go. Whatever you guys did, trust me, I did it years and years ago. I think it was maybe 7 years ago. I did the same exact thing you guys did. Yeah, only I did it in July instead of November.
I can't even imagine.
It was not ideal. It was pretty. I remember on our way down, I was like, we don't have enough water. We went with 4 people. We all had big bottles of water. By the time we got down, the water was gone. And that was the easy part. Yeah. And it was still early enough to where it wasn't that long, hot part of the day. I mean, I know they have it in November. But imagine July, the hot, like, the second hottest month of the year.
I can't.
This is what I remember about the trip. And, you know, the views were amazing. And we were there for sunrise. And it was epic. And I remember that, too. But I remember the walk up the canyon at like 12 o'clock, like noon or 1 o'clock, and it was just like no. And as we're going up, we're seeing like people go down, and they have kids, and there's old people, and there's no backpack to speak of. They don't have. It's clear they don't have any sort of beverage with them, and I'm just like, I want to stop them and be like, listen, you don't know what you're like. Unless you stop right now, you're in for a long second half of the day. So I didn't, you know.
Either they're in for a long half or they're like these amazing, like Sherpa people that just do this every day. Like it's no problem. Yeah, like they've been there.
The guy with the Phoenix t-shirt from the airport, you know, look, he's from Staten Island. He's this Sherpa.
But yeah, the Grand Canyon is, I don't think you should live a lifetime without seeing it. I have never seen anything like it. The closest thing I saw was the glaciers in Alaska that wowed me like that. But I have never seen anything like the Grand Canyon.
That's on my bucket list, Alaska, and especially specifically glaciers.
Yeah. So I don't want to spend all the time in the canyon, but we come down. We did Sedona because we were gonna go visit the girlfriend's family. She had family out there, right outside of Phoenix. And we're like, let's stop in Sedona. I was thinking just stopping, like just. Get there, I'm like, holy crap. Yeah. It looks like a scene out of a movie. It's red rocks everywhere, mountains, trees, and I'm just like, wow. I'm like, that's like my thing. I'm like, wow. You know, I love like nature and scenery and stuff like that. And we ate at a little brewery. More of like a brew pub. Beer was like just safe beer, like all threes, you know. Like, mm-hmm. You know, they have your porter, your IPA, or, you know. But food was phenomenal. And I'm like, we got to do something while we're here. So we went and got an ATV, like the off-roading vehicle.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the bike, the quads. I've been on quads before, but it was like those Polaris, like buggies. Like, God. And they let you go out. It's not like you're on this like area and they're like, here's the trails, go play on them. They're like, okay, you got to go 2 miles down the road. You got to hop on the highways to get there in the off-roading vehicle. And, awesome. Like they give you like a book with directions. You went to these like Mayan ruins, like drove up and you're out in the desert. It's like, make a right at the cactus that looks like this. Make it, you know, like, and just, I mean, those things go over everything. Everything.
Yeah, they're like ATVs, but like on steroids, right? Like they're, there's not, they didn't meet anything that they couldn't handle, right?
There
Polaris ones? Yeah. I haven't been on, I've been on ATV, but not a Polaris, but they look
there
crazy.
There was times where I wasn't sure I was going to get, and I'm like.
And you can go fast.
I'm a maniac. I just was like flooring it. Girlfriend's screaming the entire time. I'm like, right, there's a rock. At one point she yells, there's a rock. I'm like, oh, really?
What?
Here?
Where? Show me.
But this thing just goes over everything, and it's like a lot of fun. And eventually she drove. We went back. We went up to like the top of it. Saw everything. We were going, I mean, you're just bouncing back and forth. But the thing never loses traction. It's amazing. So it was that was well worth the experience. It was.
What did they get you for? I was just going to say,
it was $250. We got 4 hours, though, which I didn't think was that bad.
Not terrible.
I mean, if you think about that, that's less than $70 an hour.
Yeah, that's not bad. I remember my Sedona trip almost more than...
Well, just one thing. Okay, but, like, jet skis, think about it. Like, I rented jet skis for a half hour in Florida. Yeah, they were $60, $70. So yeah. It's like you're getting the experience of the vehicle, plus you're sightseeing everything. So it's like, to me, it was... Awesome. Well worth it.
Jet skis are a ripoff. Unless you own one, they're such a rip. Yeah, exactly. They're such a ripoff. I remember my Sedona trip so much more than the Grand Canyon trip.
Probably because you were hallucinating on the way up.
I just remember as soon as we got into the town, just seeing all. Yeah, you're right. The rocks, like they're standing tall and they're bright colors. And I'm a sucker for that too. And I just remember how awesome it was. We did this crazy devil something hike. That took like 2 hours, and I was just, the Grand Canyon's nicer, and it's crazier, and it's much more awe-inspiring and bigger, but I think I enjoyed the trip to Sedona more.
I could see
because
that.
It wasn't, it was just very, like, low-key, but also just amazing. Like, there was no pressure to do anything. It was just kind of do whatever you want. The Grand Canyon, the Grand Canyon's like, you gotta experience it. Sedona's like, you're just being there is experiencing, which is kind of true for the canyon, but you, like, feel... You feel like you have to keep going with the canyon. Sedona just like whatever you want. It's got whatever you want to offer. It's true.
Like it's crazy. There's like it's basically a town just built into like the most beautiful scenery.
It's a nice town. It's a really nice
restaurants,
little town.
Restaurants,
yeah.
Brew pubs, everything. Like shopping, art galleries everywhere. So Sedona was fantastic also. And then we made our way down to Scottsdale. Checked out two breweries. Two Brothers Brewing and Goldwater Brewing. Goldwater's cool. I got a crowler of it was a cactus ale. It's like this. It was called Desert Rose, and it was like glowing red, and it was just like a very subtle, easy drinking, but it had this like agave kind of taste at the end. I loved it, so I brought that back. So then we saw the family. We woke up. We went to Phoenix. For breakfast, and then I've heard of Arizona Wilderness Brewery, and I looked it up when I was at the Grand Canyon. I'm like, wow, that's too far. I'm not gonna be able to get there. Mm-hmm. We get to the air, like we eat breakfast, and we're like, we have like 4 hours before the flight, and then I realized that from Phoenix it was only 25 minutes. I'm like, well,
that's nothing.
Well, we're going,
yeah, and especially before a flight.
That brewery, I've heard about it just because the collaborations they do with Other Half, and I had that one City Slicker beer. It was great, and I heard, I hear rumblings of it on their beer websites and whatnot, and it was everything and more that I could ever imagine. The beer, everything was, like, locally foraged and ingredient things. They had I was texting you when I was there. There was a Jimmy World beer, like a collab with Jimmy World, and it was probably one of the best ones on the menu. It was just this wet IPA, and then they had a pecan pie thing, and I don't want to just talk about flavors, but it was just... It was that wow factor of the first time when I went to Dogfish, like the first when I first remember like a brewery with all these crazy ingredients, but then like more modernly, like Tired Hands, it was on par with that. Like it was just as good. And I have a little crowler open up.
The only thing I've had from them is the collab with Other Half, the City Slickers.
Yep.
I thought that was great. Yep. I had that actually a lot. I think I had like three cans, and I had it on tap twice. And I just, every time I saw it, I just ordered it because I was in the city when that came out. They're definitely on my list of places I'd like to go. If I'm ever in Arizona again, I will 100% go there. They're like
on that short list of like breweries in other states that if you can trade for or visit or whatever you got to do, just do it. There's a couple like in random states, Arizona, Georgia, Colorado, Texas, and it's like they're on the list.
It blew, like it's funny because like from afar, it doesn't look like anything impressive. It kind of looks like a, it might have used to been an Applebee's or something, but they just kind of put, but don't inside, beautiful. The little patio area, beautiful. And then the tasting room was just, it just was everything. And then, of course, I'm like, got to buy a shirt, got to buy a crowd.
You got to buy everything.
Yeah. But
support small business.
That was the icing on the cake, was Arizona Wilderness Brewery. So I will endorse them, not that it matters, but 100%. If you're ever in Arizona and you like craft beer, take the 20-minute drive from Phoenix, 25-minute drive. And it, like I said, it was probably top five breweries for me that I've ever been to. And I've been to a lot.
You should try to get one of the guys on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's a good idea. But or you should. You stick to beer.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Maybe I'll come on and.
Why didn't I think of that?
But let's shift gears and get out of here. Steve, last time we talked, it got cut out because the episode was too long. But yet again, we're sitting here 3 hours on the recorder. You had asked me, now, as a performer, you know, trying to break into the comedy industry, I do it as much as I possibly can. You had asked me, my Mount Rushmore of comedians, which is a hard question in general, or music, or any, if you ask me any of that, you know, your top four. And I actually thought about it since that episode because I listened to it.
All right.
And yeah, we had a couple of beers, but I think, I don't think I answered it personally. I think I answered it more, this is socially, what is the Mount Rushmore? So I have a different view, but real quick, you said you were always a giant stand up comedy fan. Myself, I know I mentioned on the podcast, so I'm not going to go into my background, but it was Saturday mornings. It was Comedy Central, the specials that were on, the hours, the half hours, the Dice Clays and stuff like that. And all this stuff kept evolving. The Opie and Anthony show, where you get to hear comedians be themselves, that really influenced me. But I don't want to go into completely that. Let's talk more about you real quick, and then we'll go into the Mount Rushmore conversation. Right. Get the hell out of here.
I was, like I said to you before, I was such a weird child. I, for some reason, I just loved stand-up growing up.
God, but you're such a normal adult.
I've assimilated very well since that stage of my life. You're
the next letter in the LGBTQ.
Yeah, Q-S.
And then Steve.
LGBTQS. It's not plural. It's me. I don't know. I loved stand-up comedy growing up. I loved laughing. I loved. It wasn't even so much if it made me laugh. My favorite comedian of all time, and this will never change, is always George Carlin.
Yep.
And his later specials, I don't know if I laughed as much because he made me think so much.
Yep.
Right? And it was the way.
Still does. Some of his bits still are relevant.
More relevant than ever. Yep. And it wasn't because he was funny, which he was, and his early stuff is, and his later stuff is proof of that, but it wasn't because he was so funny. It was because the way he was able to talk to the crowd and his ability to, he was a wordsmith if there ever was one, and he was able to put words together.
100%.
And his stream of consciousness was unlike anything I ever saw and probably will ever see again. So that's why he is number one on my Rushmore, and I think I said the Rushmore last time, but the other ones.
Well, it didn't make it, so go ahead.
So it's Carlin, Chappelle, Louis C.K., and then the fourth is usually bounces back and forth between Seinfeld and Brian Regan, but I got to put Seinfeld on it at this point. Sorry, Brian Regan. You've super had two great specials.
Super respectable four.
And that's just because I think about the four comedians that I've watched the most that have made me laugh the most, but also, it's not just about the laughter. It's about how you talk to the audience, how you frame your thoughts, how you put your thoughts into words, and the funniest way to get that out. And Carlin was the best that I ever saw. I'm sure some people say Pryor, and some people say Eddie Murphy, and like those are all great, and I have no problem with them at all. But stand-up comedy, as I know it, and it wasn't just stand-up comedy. I was so weird. I watched Now, Politically Incorrect and Dennis Miller Live and shows like this. As a kid, I was religious about these shows.
My favorite,
11-year-old.
My favorite was
weird.
Tough Crowd. I know it was like probably, what was that, high school, college?
That was, Was that Comedy Central or was that?
That was HBO? Comedy Central.
Yeah, that was Comedy Central.
No, but
yeah.
I mean, like, where were you? I can't remember. Colin Quinn. College or
Tough Guy with Colin Quinn.
Well, yeah. Well, with everyone that was great at the time
he
was on
it. Yeah, right.
Carlin was on it once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
DePaulo and Norton and Patrice and Geraldo and Dennis Leary was on an episode and every name was on that show. And it was a way to see comics not on stage doing their material in the raw. Like, for the most part, it just talking, you know. Best show I still go on YouTube and watch Tough Crowd sometimes at night, just the episodes, and it makes me laugh. It's still relevant. And Colin Quinn is he's a beast, you know.
He is very funny. And not only funny, but
intelligent.
Like the type of exactly, that type of comedy where even when he's not being funny, he's making you think.
One of my favorite lines of him, the gun law thing, he's like, "Yeah, of course, everyone had guns in 1776, but also half the country was bears."
See, I didn't even know that line, but that's funny. Yeah, exactly, and it's true, and it's like it's funny to think about stuff like that. So I just and the funny thing is, as much as I love stand up, I never once thought about getting up and doing an open mic.
I was just
going
to say, did you ever think about
it? Never once. Never once did I think. I would love to be able to do it. I think it would be so much fun to be good at it, but I don't know if I don't have the balls or if I don't have the bit. I don't have the mental capacity.
I think it would be so much fun to be good at it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, you're still holding out hope, buddy.
Plugging along.
One show at a time. But yeah, no, it's I never once thought of, you know, going to an open mic and trying to do a bit. Never once. And which is why I wanted to pick your brain so much about it, because it seems like we have the same thoughts on stand-up comedy, but you went the other route and you wanted to try to do it. And now you host all these crazy shows and you open for all these awesome comics and you...
I try.
Maybe you've headlined a show. I don't know.
No. I actually don't want to headline a show anytime soon. Comedy kind of found me. It sounds so gay. Comedy found me. Not gay. It sounds so LGBT. No. But
Vernie's going to come back.
I know. Vernie's going to say no.
Fuck you up.
But comedy, like, again, I watched it all the time, Saturday mornings. Loved it. Loved it in college. Loved it. You know, it was always kind of like, it was something that inspired me. And I was always kind of the goofball in class. And but I was also, like, a good student. I wasn't, like, the typical, like, class clown. I went second place.
You picked your spots.
Second place class clown in high school. The first place guy is in jail. So by proxy, I was the class clown. You know, like, but the point is that I did it a little bit in college, right? And I loved it. I did it open mics, and I had awful material. It was all sexual and terrible and dirty, and it had no real writing to it. But I loved it. If I got that little tiny. I loved it. And it was probably more because I was saying inappropriate words. Now I fast forward 10 years later, whatever it was. I don't even... Now I almost work, I would say, 80% clean. Like, I want to make my bits more, almost 100% about me. So you're either with me or not. Not to say that's going to get laughs, but I know that I'm writing from me. That's it. I'm not writing about... You ever have said, you know, like
to or, you, it's funny.
Yeah, to me, it's funny, and it's got to be funny first here to be funny elsewhere. But I suppressed the comedy writing for years. I never did. I always wanted to do it. I mentioned it even before I got married to my ex girlfriend. How I always wanted to do it. I got married, did the house, did the whole thing, all the you know the regular life, and suppressed it. Never did it. And then when like things are going really bad, I really feel like comedy. Like, almost called me back. It feels weird to say that, or maybe it doesn't make sense to anyone else, but it was like, I want to go do this. And it was a way to, like, write bits about what was going on in my life, make people laugh about them, or see something if they could relate, or not, make people not laugh at them. But I felt like I was doing something, and I've always been this, like, person who can't sit still. I have to be, like, doing something creative. I was a musician my whole life. I actually have a little page coming out soon, but I'm going to post all my old music and write a little like thing about it and ask other people to post their old music and write where they were in their life and funny things about it and stuff. But so I'm going to try to do that because I want that. Like, I was always being creative. And then I felt like for 3 years, I just stopped doing anything creative. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not have been like a reason that things didn't work out. Maybe I was suppressed, you know, like maybe I wasn't mm-hmm. happy, you know.
You need an outlet. Everyone needs an outlet, right?
But like creativity was always the thing for me. So comedy, now I feel like, okay, I'm at the bottom of it, but I feel like I'm finally starting to turn the page where mm-hmm. I'm starting to get comfortable. Now I'm 2.5-3 years back into it, and I'm just feeling okay on stage. Like, I'm not panicking beforehand. I'm going on stage being kind of relaxed and being like, hey, this joke don't work. I got a million other things. So it is this thing that I love, and it'll never go away. And if someone who loves me doesn't understand that, I'm sorry. It's part of me now. It's ingrained in me. The musician thing might come back, sure. But what I love about comedy is I'm not working on other people's schedules, which in right. the bands, it was the worst. It was, yeah. you know, we got this great song, but this guy's got work every Tuesday for the next 5 months. You know, like, we can't play it again, you know? But, okay. So comedy Mount Rushmore, real quick, before the podcast hits 9 hours long. I thought about this a lot to make it personal to me by Mount Rushmore. Now, Pryor would be up there. I love Pryor. Carlin would be up there. I love Carlin. And I put them on last time we talked. I said, those are the.
Yeah, that.
That wasn't true. Really? Wasn't. No, no. Are they on the Mount Rushmore in comedy business?
Yes, right.
100%.
Right, no, your Rushmore is
my
different than
Rushmore.
The Rushmore.
My Rushmore. Okay. It goes a little something like this. Eddie Murphy. Okay, Eddie Murphy was probably the reason I really started paying attention to comedy. I had Delirious. And then I found Roll, like a lot of people. And it was play, rewind. Hilarious. The Ice Cream Man sketch, it's still like, your daddy's on welfare.
The Cosby stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Cosby with Pryor. Him talking to Pryor about Cosby? Oh, man. That's some of my favorite stuff ever.
Number two, time in my life. Same. He's on your Mount Rushmore, Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
When we were going into college, I think Chappelle's show was kind of at its peak.
2001 was when it started,
right?
I think.
So exactly
that first episode, I remember. Like, my god!
I had seen Chappelle. My ex got me tickets to a Chappelle show in Connecticut, and I saw Chappelle a couple years ago at the Oddball Comedy Festival. He's above and beyond thinker of his material. So smart and so not. Right. Stereotypical black comedian,
the way his brain works is like above anyone else. Like, there's very few comedians that can just take you can tell even in his SNL thing a couple of days ago. Amazing. You can tell when he's improvising, the whatever his response is, whatever his initial reaction response is funny, and it's funnier than things most people would ever think. Like, he just. I mean, like, that's what it is. When you're a funny guy, you're a funny guy. And he, like, the stuff that he wrote, Killing Me Softly or Killing Him Softly, or those two, remember when he was really
one
skinny?
One in D.C., whatever. Oh, yeah, man. Now he's jacked.
I can't
tell you. The one in D.C., whatever one that is the best
we
one.
We watch in college.
Let's sprinkle some crack on him.
Yeah, exactly. And the other one, the one about when he met an Indian at the supermarket, and I want to meet your chief.
I want to meet your chief.
I thought you were dead. Yeah. Like that, those two specials, I can't tell you how many times I watched that. I could go word for word on them, and just like the way his mind works is it's the best in the business. Seriously.
Now, the third one is for me is now looking at it as a perspective as a comic, or I'm a comic, whatever. Yeah. But now looking at it through the lens of a comic is Patrice O'Neill.
Really?
Patrice O'Neill. Really?
And he's funny. He's
by far funny guy. A guy that could deal with anything on stage or nothing on stage. He can go up with absolutely nothing and command an audience. Demand, just crush an audience into submitting to him. A slayer on stage. Every comic you hear interviewed, they were so afraid of sitting at the table with Patrice O'Neill because he would dominate and shut everyone up. His material, here's a guy who he sabotaged himself all the time as far as getting big. He would go into there's stories. He says like he would have all these deals and go in and start bitching about the service, bitching about the intern and stuff like that, and just blow things up. But if you listen to Elephant in the Room, was I think his coup de grace, one of the funniest comedy specials ever. But there's an album called Mr. Pete, which was recorded just on a regular night at a DC club, I think it was, or some. And it's just this masterful thing of him whipping a crowd into a frenzy. And hearing him on Opie and Anthony, which I listened to for a long time, and Tough Crowd.
Yeah.
One of the most loud, vile, arrogant, but also like really insightful. He knew he was dying, which is mm-hmm. amazing. Like, so honestly, that would be number three for me.
I mean, it's respectful. I mean, yeah. I when you hear people talk about him, it's always in the vein of no one was funnier than him. Like, no one in the room was funnier than Patrice O'Neill, unless he was in a room with like.
I saw Patrice twice.
I never cracked me up. I think I saw him maybe once, but I'm pretty shaky on it, yeah. So it's possible I never saw him. But I mean, every time people talk about him, it's always he was the funniest guy in the room.
No, I mean. No, so yeah, that's three black guys for me. Three black guys.
Murphy
Chappelle, O'Neill.
Okay.
I thought about this a lot since the last time.
And the fourth is a wild card. It's always the wild card. It's always
the hometown. The wild card because of my comedy and the times I've seen him and the person he is. And I think I mentioned to you this last time. Now, I will tell you that five and six would be Bill Burr's. And Louis C.K. would be mm-hmm. five and six for me. Seinfeld for his show would be right in there. I love his stand-up, but his show was part of my, literally from like 11th, 10th grade till now. You know, yeah, still watching.
Exactly.
But Jim Brewer is my favorite comic of all time.
Oh, man. Favorite comic of all time, number four on Rushmore.
Well, no particular. I feel like when you're in Rushmore, it's no real order.
Oh, it's just it's like you're there.
It touches you in different spots.
Lincoln's number four, but you know,
Jim Brewer did so much for me, like as a comic, like because I love that he is like a family guy. I love his post that he's a.
But he's a lot of impressions, and your comedy is not as far as I know, no impressions.
No,
so.
But his movement, his energy, his genuine stories about his family—that's where I try to take mm-hmm. things from. Pretty much don't do any impressions.
Right, yeah,
probably won't. But and his comedy actually isn't a lot. It used
no,
to
it's
be
not all, but it's,
it used
it's,
to be Pesci yeah, and Goldman.
A couple of his stand-ups are pretty impression heavy.
Maybe he's not the greatest comic ever, but it's the times I've had watching him. It's the learning from him. It's learning what a great guy that I hear from other comics that he is. That mm-hmm. he'll give the shirt off his back to like comics and his dad. The stories he wrote about taking his dad on the road. When he was like shitting his pants, he was basically taking care of his dad for 10 hours a day, going on stage, bring his dad to the side of the stage to watch the show, and then taking care of him. And like, I don't know, his wife has breast cancer now, he lost his sister. And like, seeing his positive outlook on life is like super inspiring. So it's not really just because of his comedy, it's because of the person he is and reading his books. And so. That's my surprise pick. So my Mount Rushmore is those four guys for various reasons. Some for their comedy, some for the person they are. And I told you, it would be C.K. Burr. Seinfeld would be the next there.
5, 6, 7.
But as a performer, Patrice O'Neill, seeing him. As far as energy, Jim Brewer. As far as...
nostalgia is Eddie Murphy.
Nostalgia is complete Murphy. And a time in my life when I really got vested into the comedy was Chappelle. And that would be my Mount Rushmore.
That's
Dude, Carlin Pryor, Red Fox.
Cosby.
Oh, Cosby. Yes. But in my personal life, Carlin would be the closest to that. To where I would be. But... It was funny because I did when I was editing the podcast, I'm like, I can't put this in because this...
That's not right.
This isn't
that's,
true.
That's
this
not
is,
right.
This is way too many beers in that I'm disagreeing with you. I'm disagreeing with you.
Yeah, and Mike said something. And his was different too, right? We got to give him another chance. Yeah,
we will definitely do that when he gets back. But Steve, let's get out of here. You have anything to promote?
I promoted Stick to Beer last time. I think I had a couple episodes up since then. SoundCloud.com/stick to beer. Follow us on Instagram. That's really it. Go to my blog, stevensparrow.com/blog.
Next time I'm coming on your podcast.
Yes, I will. Change it up. Next time you come on my podcast, I will have excellent recording stuff like you do, or I can just poach your stuff and you can send me the MP3 file. No.
Or I could just bring my recording stuff to you.
Yes, that's true. We could do that. But yeah, and next time we can talk about beer. And
maybe we could do get Arizona Wilderness on. I'll try to work on that.
Excellent
that
idea.
That would be awesome.
Excellent idea.
Let's do that. We could do a collaboration.
Collab.
I will promote real quick. This will come out on Monday. So I have a show in Asbury Park at the Saint, the rock club that I played with at my with bands back in the day. I'm very excited. It should be really cool. It's like $5 or $10 to enter.
Yeah, when is this?
Come see me and Joe Fernandez. It's Tuesday, the 22nd.
Yeah.
We'll be there, and it should be a blast. And the guy who runs it's a super genuine young dude in comedy, so support him. Come on out, have a drink with us, and that's really it. And please listen to the podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes. Leave a review. Go tell Tom Verney you loved what you heard. Life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.